coming up on Boston Public Radio. That fight in D.C. over college loan rates did nothing to bring the cost of college down. State Rep Dan Winslow thinks he can. Callie Crossley then joins us with an under-the-radar preview. And what do reporters do when nothing's happening at the Bolger trial? They look at defense attorney J.W. Carney's purple toenails. We'll talk men and pedicures. Then Emily with a Tsarnaev and Todashev update, plus Emily's list. Then an MIT professor on the herding instinct on those online restaurant and product reviews. And finally, when it's August and you can't book anyone for the Friday news quiz, what do? You book the bookers. Producers from Greater Boston and BPR go at it. That's all next on Boston Public Radio.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. U.S. and Russian officials are meeting in Washington today, shortly after President Obama snubbed Russian President Vladimir Putin by calling off a planned visit to Moscow. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports Secretary of State John Kerry is trying to lighten the mood.
As he and Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel met their Russian counterparts, Kerry pointed out that this is a relationship marked by shared interests and at times colliding ones.
Sergei Lavrov and I are old hockey players, and we both know that diplomacy, like hockey, can sometimes result in the occasional collision.
Foreign Minister Lavrov said the two sides need to act like grown-ups. Russia was disappointed that Obama canceled the planned summit with Putin next month. Lavrov says they were going to reach some deals on boosting trade, but the White House says it wasn't making progress on arms control and other issues. The administration was also angry over Russia's decision to grant temporary asylum to NSA leaker Edward Snowden. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
Former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice tells CBS that she believes President Obama was right to cancel a summit with Russian President Putin after Moscow granted temporary asylum to the American analyst who leaked U.S. state secrets. She says Putin's support of Edward Snowden was a slap in the face. The State Department is now warning Americans not to travel to Pakistan because of a terrorist threat to the U.S. consulate in Lahore. Non-essential personnel are being evacuated. U.S. officials say the latest threat is not related to another warning about Al-Qaeda that prompted the U.S. to shutter embassies and consulates in parts of the Middle East and Africa. President Obama signs a student loan bill into law today. NPR's Ari Shapiro reports this ends a fight that had dragged on in Congress for months.
This bill lowers student loan rates just in time for the new school year to start. White House spokesman Jay Carney praised the parties for getting the job done.
This is a bill that passed with wide majority support on both sides of the aisle and will save millions of students an average of $1,500 on loans they take out this year.
Rates will likely go up over time, though. For now, they're close to 4%. This bill ties the interest rate to the 10-year Treasury note, so as the economy improves, the rate will go up. This bill caps the rate at 8.25%. Even with this bill, most everyone agrees that college is out of reach for too many people. Congress and the White House both plan to look at other ways to make college affordable after the summer break. Ari Shapiro, NPR News, the White House.
The wildfire burning in the mountains east of Los Angeles is growing more destructive. An inferno that swept across 22 square miles is moving closer to the desert town of Cabazon. So far, more than 24 homes are gone. Hundreds more could face a similar fate. Many residents have already evacuated. Gunmen are holding two Turkish airline crew members hostage in Lebanon. The ambush took place on an old airport road between an airport and hotel in Beirut. At last check on Wall Street, Dow was down 119 points. This is NPR News.
From the WGBH Radio Newsroom in Boston, I'm Judy Ewell with the local stories we're following. It's day four of deliberations for jurors in the murder and racketeering trial of reputed crime boss James Whitey Bulger. And prosecutors complained this morning that a defense attorney is trying to influence the panel. This morning, Prosecutor Brian Kelly asked Judge Denise Casper to admonish Bulger's attorney, J.W. Carney Jr., citing Carney's comment to reporters praising the jury's diligence. Kelly called that an obvious attempt to influence the panel. Carney says he was making a neutral comment. The judge did not make any immediate action on the request. Bulger, of course, is charged in a sweeping racketeering indictment that includes his alleged participation in 19 murders. A New Jersey woman is charged with trying to defraud the charity set up to aid survivors of the Boston Marathon bombings. Police say 44-year-old Iris Gamble of Linden submitted a claim to the One Fund Boston saying she was injured during the April 15 blasts. Gamble said she was treated for her injuries at a hospital in Newark. But a closer look at her paperwork led officials to believe that the claim was a fake. Union County Prosecutor Grace Park says Gamble wasn't even in Boston for the marathon. Gamble's charged with attempted theft by deception, fraud, and creating fraudulent documents. And police in Connecticut say the brother of former Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown has been charged with impersonating a police officer. Police say 46-year-old Bruce Brown stopped three vessels on Long Island Sound yesterday and asked boaters for their vessels' registrations and safety for certificates. He had three loaded handguns, handcuffs, and a bulletproof vest marked police in his car. Support for NPR comes from the Weinstein Company with Lee Daniels, The Butler, inspired by a true story and starring Forrest Whitaker and Oprah Winfrey. The Red Sox meet the Kansas City Royals again tonight. We'll have cloud showers, thunderstorms this afternoon, highs only in the 70s. Clouds and showers overnight, lows in the 70s. Right now, it's 73 in Boston. For more news, visit WGBHnews.org.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. Marjorie Egan has the day off. Sitting or standing in her place is Sue O'Connell, the co-publisher of Bay Windows and the South End News. Hello, Sue O'Connell.
Hey, Jim.
Nice to see you.
Good to see you, too.
You know, student loan debt could come to define the millennials. In 2011, two-thirds of college students graduated with an average of $27,000 in debt. And that fight in D.C. over college loan interest rates did nothing to bring the cost of college down. One state rep thinks he can. He's State Representative Dan Winslow from Norfolk, and he's joining us now. Dan, how are you?
I'm great, Jim. I'm thrilled to be on with Sue.
Isn't this exciting?
What a treat.
We've kind of been internet dating, so this is exciting to speak in person. Representative Winslow, can you break down? You've got a sort of three-prong approach to this. Can you break down for our listeners what your method is and what your goal is?
Sure. And let me just step back really quickly and emphasize what Jim has already said is the problem. There's over $1 trillion of outstanding debt for student loans in the United States. That's more debt than all credit card debt combined. And that is what we have saddled our next generation of our economic drivers for our state and our national economy with. And it's frankly, it's unsustainable. One out of eight student loans are being defaulted on right now. And I think that that's a significant bubble in our financial sector as well. So we have a huge problem, and we have to get our hands around it. In my view, government has been part of the driver of this problem. Both state and federal government inject copious amounts of money into effectively the closed economy of higher education. And as money comes into any economy, of course, prices naturally rise. There's no pushback. There's no countervailing market forces, if you will, to keep costs down. And for that reason, higher education costs have far outpaced other cost of living increases, the consumer price index and cost of housing and cost of, you know, if you look at almost any comparable index, higher ed tops almost all of them, I think, with the exception of healthcare.
So how are you going to rein them in? How are you going to rein college costs in, Dan Winslow?
I want to start to inject some market forces. There's basically three approaches that I have suggested, two in the legislation yesterday that I filed. We are already in the student loan space. We have something called MEFA, the Massachusetts Education Finance Authority, and I've proposed that we change the enabling statute for MEFA to give the agency power to offer differential interest rates. And if a college or university signs a pledge, a binding pledge, that they will cap increases in tuitions and fees at CPI or less, for years 2, 3, and 4 for a four-year school, or year 2 for a two-year school, that if they promise that any increase in tuition will be less than CPI, Consumer Price Index, for those years, that their students that attend their school, and this, by the way, is any university in America where a Massachusetts resident is attending, that their students get lower-cost student loans. And I propose that it be as low as 0%. Now, the flip side of that is that MEFA would have the ability to charge higher rates of interest for student loans for universities that do not agree to keep a cap on their cost. And
Dan
so
Winslow,
that's how it's funded.
Two questions about step one in your plan. Why? One, what's in it for the university to do it? And two, why not include the first year of college in this plan?
I'll take the second question first. So the first year is the only year where there are market forces in play in higher education to any great extent, because the universities, among comparable universities, they compete for their incoming class. So I don't want to have a price cap that gives them no flexibility. They might have unanticipated expenses. If they need to make up more money, let them make it up on the incoming class. But that class, they're competing with other universities, comparable universities, and so those market forces will temper any increase in cost. What's in it for the universities is this. If a university agrees to keep their cost increases under control, inflation or less, that they will have a competitive advantage in attracting Massachusetts students over their comparable or competitor schools. So, for example, we already know the financial aid, and there's complicated algorithms that universities already use to determine yield and maximize enrollment, you know, get different characteristics and demographics for their university classes. We already know that among comparable colleges, price matters. Mm-hmm. And so if you're a student, you're accepted to, you know, College A and College B, they're, you know, all things being equal, they're comparable schools. College A has agreed to the price protector pledge, which means you get a 0% student loan, or College B, which hasn't, and it's a 6% student loan. Where do you think you're more likely to go?
No, I agree with you.
That's okay.
Dan, you're a fan of the TV show Northern Exposure. Do you remember that show?
Yeah.
Where the guy went to college and med school, and he had to pay back his loan by going to, you know, Alaska or someplace you've got a part of this plan which I'm a big fan of, which the state of Oregon has this pay it forward, pay it back plan. The first time I heard this plan, I thought it was a great idea. This is part of your idea as well.
Yes, the second section in the bill that I filed yesterday has asked MEFA, the Mass Education Financing Authority, to study whether we can adapt the Oregon Pay Forward Payback Plan here in Massachusetts. And what that would do, Sue, is it would allow kids, students, to be able to have their education now without cost and to pay back out of future earnings. You know, because you're effectively investing in the intellectual capital of your students, of your Massachusetts residents. And it's not debt in the traditional sense. And so the idea is to have less conventional debt carried by our students. The third idea, which I filed last term, and the House actually...
Well, wait, before you go ahead. And so the way that a college would be paid for is a certain percentage of a postgraduate student's life, their earnings, would go back to the state after the fact, so not debt.
Exactly.
And but before you go to your third step, we spoke to Barbara Dudley, I think from Portland State, the woman whose class actually came up with this idea. I don't know if you're aware, Dan, you may be. The vote in the legislature in Oregon was 100%. Every Republican and every single Democrat voted for, which is almost unheard of here. Getting back to your first idea, this notion of creating an incentive for colleges to keep tuition and fees down, you were part of an endangered species, as we know. You're a Republican on Beacon Hill. Is there any Democratic interest in this plan?
Yeah, actually, I got a really enthusiastic call from my colleague Tom Golden, who's a state representative from Lowell, and I've invited Republicans and Democrats to join. This is not a partisan issue. This is a Massachusetts issue. We've got to do this. And I think it's Republican only in the sense that I'm trying to use market forces. And it's voluntary, by the way. You know, there's no reason why we can't just change the Enabling Act to give MEFA this power. Nobody's forced to do it. By the way, you know, the first adopters will be. The Massachusetts, you know, private schools will fiercely oppose this, because why would they want to have more, you know, competitive pressures? But you know who will adopt this? You know, University of Texas, where there may be five kids from Massachusetts attending. Of course they're going to adopt it. And then as the geography gets closer and closer to Massachusetts, the pressure will ratchet up.
Okay,
and
so what's
something will happen over time.
I interrupt you. What's the third point, Representative Winslow?
The third point was it is entirely, I've spoken to experts in higher education about this, it's entirely possible. There's no excuse why we cannot have college, a bachelor's degree, in 3 years of study. Instead of getting out in May, you get out in June, and you can basically have 3.5 semesters, which it's entirely possible to have a degree in 3 years rather than four, particularly if you combine it with online learning to, you know, for one or two classes. And the idea is, you know, it's not optimal, perhaps. And I understand there's a lot about the college education and the higher education process that occurs outside the classroom. But if you've got college education that costs almost $60,000 and growing, we've got to make higher education available to students. It's just not right. It's just not right to say to students, you have a Hobson's choice. You have to have a college education or you have to be saddled with insurmountable debt. And that's a terrible choice to give our young people. And you know what? We don't have to. We have it within our power to leverage the buying power of our state's MEFA bonds, which we already issue, and start saying, you know what? Affordability is a value in Massachusetts. And for our residents and our students, we will give a competitive advantage to any university that agrees that affordability is a key value for higher education.
You know, Dan, at minimum, I hope everybody agrees that this starts a conversation that is critical to the well-being of middle-class families and poor families in this country and the Commonwealth. Before you go, though, you know, I'm a huge believer, I know you are, in the power of ideas. But despite that, you had to throw an ice cream social to get people to your press. That's pretty pathetic, isn't it?
Well, no, it was actually kind of fun. So we have about 200 interns, summer interns at the State House, the legislative branches.
Oh, it was for them?
So it was for the interns.
You're mean.
You know, I'm a big believer in the power of thank you. I really am. And you know, I mean, I want to treat employees and interns fairly. But, you know, thank you goes a long way, and people just don't do it nearly often enough. So I thought, I'll do an ice cream social. And then I thought, well, what a great opportunity to talk about affordability for college students.
You know, if I had known you were serving ice cream, I would have shown up at the press conference. Dan, before you go away, any of the interns you dealt with have huge college debts before they got to you?
Yes, except for the kids that are fortunate enough to, you know, to secure scholarships or, you know, for the public schools particularly. But, you know, private school education, I just my daughter goes to Colgate at $58,000 a year. Now, that started at $54,000 last year, I think. So it's just going up exponentially, and that's not untypical of private colleges.
I have one at Smith and one at Emerson, so believe me, you're preaching to the choir here. Dan Winslow, thanks so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me on.
We're going to open up the lines at 877-301-8970. That's 877-301-8970. What kind of student loan debt are you dealing with? Are you rethinking the degree that you'll get or where you'll go to school based on the cost that comes along with the college degree?
And, you know, the context for this, which is coincidental and interesting, is today is the day that the president, Sue, is scheduled to sign the deal that was brokered on this interest rate thing. Remember, it went from 3.4 to 6.8. They negotiated a deal that went, I think it goes down to 3.9, but ultimately market forces will allow it to go, depending on what level of school you're at, to 8, 9, or 10%. As Sue said, our number is 877-301-8970. What's your student debt situation? What's your kid's student debt situation? If you're a parent, how much of that freight are you handling? And I have to say, these ideas, unless someone disabuses me of this notion, Sue, are such common sense ideas. The legislature should go into session today, discuss them for a couple of hours, and pass them and give whatever it's called, MEFA, is that the name of the organization?
Yes.
The power to do these kinds of negotiations. It is the notion that, as I said at the top, the average is $27,000. You and I both know people with $100,000, $150,000.
Yep.
It totally changes your life decisions because you got to say to yourself, well, I have to make enough money to be able to pay off this horrible, horrible burden, and good for Winslow for dealing with this. 877-301-8970. Let's take some calls. Champa, I hope I got your name right. You're in Andover. You're on with Sue O'Connell and Jim Browdy. Hi, Champa.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for getting me on. I love your show.
Thanks.
I just have this question. My kids are grown, and they're out of college, and they're working, but I am concerned that the student debt has become such a big issue. I'm wondering, why is it suddenly an issue? It used to be you went to college, you got a job, and you paid off your loan. Is it that nowadays when kids go and get a job, the salary is not enough for them to balance the loan and living and their other expenses like it used to be?
Well, Representative Winslow spoke about it. It's something I hadn't realized until I was out of college, is that as money became available for people to borrow to go to college, colleges raised their prices because they knew they could get the money because the government was loaning the money. So it artificially drove up the availability of loans and funding like that, drove up the costs of the private institutions. And, you know, there's also, you know, I know that if Marjorie were here, she would talk about the rock climbing wall or, you know, but there's also some specialty.
Meaning all the things that are nice to have but not necessary
and I think
at colleges.
More people have college degrees, which is a good thing. But at the same time, do we have the jobs that will pay for the cost of the college degrees?
Well, also, Champion, let me add a totally anecdotal note, which may not be proven out, but I'll give it to you anyway. I'm just thinking back to what a year of law school cost when I went, which was many, many years ago, and how it compared to my first year's salary. And I didn't go to Wall Street. I was a public interest lawyer. It was roughly one-sixth of the amount of money. 1 year at law school was roughly one-sixth of what I made, and I was a pretty low-wage lawyer. Today, if you go to a $50,000 or $60,000 a year school, you're lucky if the ratio is 1-to-1. Mm-hmm. Most kids out of school are not making $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a year. So I think the dynamic has totally changed. And the sad part is we have this huge fight in Congress over something that does matter, the interest rates, but totally on the margins, not attacking the underlying problem. Champa, thanks so much for the call. 877-301-8970. I wasn't being my usual hyperbolic self when I started. This is the debt issue for the millennials. I mean, it is so huge with no sign of it being reined in. And as Dan Winslow said, all things being relatively equal, I think the people are cost sensitive these days.
Absolutely.
And if one or two of these colleges decided to do the right thing, my guess is they'd be flooded with applications and other schools would have to catch up with them by lowering their, or at least keeping their tuition and fees at a reasonable level.
Yeah, I mean, some students are, high school students are now starting to think, well, what if I did 2 years at a community college and then 2 years at a state college and then decided if I wanted to go on for more education?
What do you think of Dan's idea for a 3-year liberal arts
thing? I think we could give most of our high school students as sophomores a GED and they would graduate. You know, we have to look at education. Are you getting education for the basis of knowledge and experience, or are you getting an education for a job? Those are two totally separate things. Are you going to college for the experience?
Well, I think you should go
valuable.
For both, don't
yeah,
you think?
Yeah, but it's valuable. But
you know,
I mean,
and Kara also talks a lot, Kara Miller from Innovation Hub talks a lot about the online stuff that Dan Winslow did too. And so you say to yourself, if you finish in 3+ years with some online courses going an extra month, as he said, let's assume it even cuts the total cost down 15-20%. That is a huge – there's got to be creative thinking and there's got to be action, and there is very little of either. Let's go to Ashley in Framingham, and you're on with Sue O'Connell and Jim Browdy on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Ashley.
Hi, how are you?
Excellent. Thank you for the call.
Good. So I'm from Connecticut, went to University of Wisconsin, then calculated how much each of my classes cost, and then decided to take a year off to get in-state tuition, which you can do in state school. Still paying off my student loan, want to go back for grad school. I've been working for the last 10 years in nonprofits, so obviously it doesn't pay a ton. But my question to you and everyone, I'm a huge advocate for people starting out in community school colleges or doing gap year programs to take time and think about what their debt is getting them into. But recently I traveled and was talking to students from around the world who their tuition annually is $4,000 top. And I just don't understand the discrepancy in how our schools in the U.S. can charge $50,000 a year when abroad it's $4,000.
Well, I can only answer that in very small part, but not sort of the macro picture. In a lot of countries in the world, if student fees are raised even 1%, there are hundreds of thousands of students on the streets. We don't do that in this country. We whine, we complain, we call radio talk. I'm not complaining about by the way.
Yeah.
But we essentially talk to our friends and complain. There's no action. So there's no pressure on people who could change this thing. State legislators, national legislators, that sort of thing. And that, as a result, colleges can charge as much as they want. Why? Because they can.
I'd offer that I think there's also something about the American illusion of being aspirational. Mm. You know, we really think that if we're paying more, we're getting more, and that given the choice, and I might disagree with Representative Winslow a little bit, between two colleges, and one's a little bit more expensive, if you can stretch and do it, people are going to do that. You know, that's sort of the American mindset. And I'm not putting a judgment on it, but it does seem that we do reach for the more expensive thing, where in other countries they don't.
I think that may have been the case in the past. I think it's less so now. Mm-hmm. I think people are being more practical, but that's, again, only anecdotal. Ashley, thanks for sharing your experience with us. We appreciate it. Let's go to Jennifer. You're in Groveland. You're on with Sue and Jim. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure.
I'm right stuck in the middle of this, so I can agree with a lot of what you're saying. I have a huge college loan. I'm 59 years old. I'm a career changer. Went back to school to become a teacher. Worked in an urban setting. I just put in for retirement. It was tough to take, but I am still going to teach in different districts. But I still have this huge loan. They won't budge with lowering the interest rate.
How much debt do you still have, Jennifer?
I owe about $50,000. I've deferred it a few times. I think I paid, I think it was 68 or 70 at one time.
Whatever happened to these programs that we read about where if you decide to go into teaching, particularly in urban areas,
in nonprofits,
get some relief. You didn't get it?
Well, I guess they have so much criteria, so many loopholes, and I should have done one more year, but honestly, I just couldn't take it. It's tough to work in an urban city.
And how do you look at the value of what you got now? I know 2020's hindsight's 2020, but
right,
you know, is it just that it didn't work out the way you wanted it to? But you're glad you got that education at that amount, or when you look back, it just was more expensive than it needed to be.
It was more expensive. Yes, I am very glad I have a master's plus. I am very glad I have the education, especially at my age. It's just going to make it easier for me to find another job. But there's a little dilemma going on with that, too, because before I was considered a highly qualified teacher, which is why I went back and got my expensive master's. What I could have done and just stayed with the bachelor's and just getting my licensure, because now they want to hire people. It's all about the MCAS scores, so they want to hire people with bachelors now to undercut the...
No, understood.
Yep.
Hey, Jennifer, good luck managing the debt. It's a sad story, but you've done great stuff. Thank you for the call. Mary, you're in Cambridge. You're on with Sue and Jim. What's up?
Hi there. I just wanted to add a slightly different twist. I'm paying off a lot of my daughter's loans right now because she hasn't been able to find a job.
Yep.
And what I'm finding is that I'm taking away from my own retirement.
Oh,
in other
gosh.
Words, I'm paying that loan instead of putting into my retirement. And it puts a multi-generational issue.
That is a
wonderful
point. I'm not
sure if that's been talked about.
No, you know, it's we talk about it in this sort of, I think the media in general, in this whimsical, oh, gee, the kids can't get jobs and they're living home and the parents are supporting it. But, you know, I think the deeper issue, which you bring to light, is that you are digging into the money that you save to take care of yourself as you retire, and you're
right.
Squeezed.
Well, you know, also, Mary, there's another angle on your story. You're saying you're doing it because your kid hasn't been able to find suitable work yet. There are a lot of parents who still feel that thing from another generation where I want to pay the bulk of my kids. Mm-hmm. I mean the generic guy. I don't mean me necessarily. One of the things I think I am supposed to do as a parent is pay the bulk of my kids' tuition, even if he or she has a decent job. I know a lot of parents in that setting, and as a result, they are saddled mm-hmm. with colossal debt, and particularly if they had kids later in life, they are really, really in a tough spot. So, Mary, I'm glad you added that perspective, and thank you very much for the call. The point of all these calls is this is a colossal problem. And again, when I'm watching this debate in Washington, should it be 6.8? Should it be 3.9? Should it be 3.4? Elizabeth Warren wanted it at the prime rate, which would have been had it under 1%, which would have been great. But even had it been 1%, that's the interest rate. The issue is, what is the interest accruing on?
Mm-hmm.
And the debt is just, it's obscene.
The students have become a revenue stream, revenue stream for the financial institutions, for the colleges. And it's, if you're just trapped under this debt for your entire life, you just can't it's just not worth it.
You mentioned community colleges before, and so did a caller. Do you remember one of the early proposals by Patrick, by Governor Patrick, was free community colleges? And I have to say, some may consider this some radical notion. I've never understood the notion. When high school was what the critical thing, without which you couldn't get a job, 30 years ago, whatever. Right. So the notion was, of course, K through 12 is free, as it's always been. Well, in light of the fact that you really can't get many jobs without either an
associate's degree
or a vocational thing or whatever, something after high school, why is it not accepted? Well, if that's the requirement to get a decent job and support your family and help the economy, why wasn't there serious debate about his proposal? Give the first 2 years of a community college education or a junior, whatever it is, give it free. It got nowhere.
Imagine if the core courses that you're going to be taking that you're paying $50,000 a year for, you could get for free at a community college. How would that dramatically change the dynamic of how much college costs?
Right, I agree. And I don't think it's a radical proposal. It's a common sense proposal. Obviously, they have to find the money somewhere. But in light of the fact that states like ours, we don't have cornfields. We have brain power. Mm-hmm. That's our resource. You got to cultivate it. Rudolph, you're in Providence. You're on with Sue and Jim. Hey.
Hey, as a college professor, I got to say, I'm glad to hear you talk about the role of the state. One of the things that was mentioned earlier was that tuition goes up and loans go up. But one of the reasons for that is because state funding has just cut off entirely in the last 20 years. You know, the University of California system used to be free if you lived there, and that's gone.
Mm-hmm. No, you're right. I mean, there are costs that are associated, and funding has changed. But to Jim's point, you know, as that state funding was federal funding was changing and state funding, nobody reacted to it.
Well, there was some from professors like you,
right,
and some
but
from students.
Not from the people paying the bill.
But not, I agree, not nearly strong enough. And Rudolph, I believe, and you probably know better than I believe the vast majority of states, because of the financial crunch they found themselves in recent years, the percentage of a college education in a public college that's being funded, subsidized by the state has gone down. That's a correct statement, is it not?
It is. I know it's true at our institution. And then, you know, what are you going to do? Are you going to go out of business? Are you going to raise tuition? Are you going to cut back on programs?
Rudolph, what do you think about the internet learning, the online learning portion?
It sounds good, but we have seen time and time again that some new technology has come out. There's been a lot of promise, a lot of hype, and it doesn't really deliver the way that the proponents claim that it will. Until they can show that it works, I'm very skeptical.
Well, I'm pretty much where you are. Kara Miller and Marjorie and I are debating this every couple of weeks. My sense is, to take your thought one step further, as a supplement to the core experience where you actually have interaction with, physical interaction with the teachers, your fellow students, etc., it probably makes a lot of sense. My fear is you end up, particularly because of the pressure of cost with the two-tier education thing, where lower-income people end up having online courses and people can afford to pay more end up going to what is a traditional college experience. Rudolph, thank you for your contribution to the discussion. Thank everybody else. And this is something we'll stay on in
it's
the days
away.
And months ahead. No, it is really
not.
And good for Winslow at least starting a discussion, and hopefully it will get him somewhere.
What are some of the important stories that have not gotten big-time press? Well, Callie Crossley will bring us that conversation next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Been out of prison now for a little over 10 months, and I live in terror every single day.
The Moth Main Stage Show, live at the Wilbur Theater in Boston on October 17th. It's a live show of real people standing on stage and sharing real stories without notes. Last year, the show sold out, but if you support Boston Public Radio with a gift of $180, you'll secure a pair of tickets to the show. For tickets and more information, visit WGBHnews.org.
WGBH programs exist because of you. And Bentley University, offering a new 11-month Bentley MBA with immersive field-based collaborations with hands-on experience at their three MBA programs and all seven of their Masters of Science degrees. Bentley, the business university. And DeCordova Sculpture Park and Museum in Lincoln, Mass. 30 acres of contemporary art set in an idyllic outdoor landscape. Plus constantly changing exhibitions in the galleries. Open every day this summer. DeCordova.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Sue O'Connell sitting in today for Marjorie Egan. Marjorie will be back on Monday. I am Jim Brady. Callie Crossley hosts Sunday nights Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. Obviously, who else could host Under the Radar with Callie Crossley? It airs Sunday at 6:30, and she's here with us now. Hey, Callie.
Hey. Hey, Callie, we did a review in Bay Windows recently of this great movie, 20 Feet from Stardom, which, you know, I worked in the radio and record business and got to know a lot of the backup singers, you know, with Sting's backup singers, and you got to see how many of them actually are on tour with some of the same folks. You saw the movie and you're already smiling.
Oh, it was fabulous. So you learn so much, you know, about who's doing these voices behind so many of the commercials and the songs that you just never knew. Mm-hmm. And the stories are fabulous. And my favorite, of course, is Mary Clayton being awakened in the middle of the night in her pajamas to go sing with the Rolling Stones. And she doesn't know have a clue. Who are they? You know.
Wait, take it through.
Yeah, you get the call.
Called to sing with the Rolling Stones. Not only does she not know who they are, she's pregnant,
yes.
She's in rollers,
right.
And her pajamas.
Exactly.
And she goes down to the studio, and the rest is history. Since you brought her up first, but we played this yesterday, but you got to play it again. Here's what she was called to the studio in the middle of the night in rollers to sing. It's obviously iconic. Here's Mary Clayton. Now, most of these women, Callie Crossley, labored in obscurity outside the industry.
Right.
Some of them, even worse, they'd sing a song for a guy like Phil Spector, who's now obviously in prison, as we mentioned yesterday.
Oh, goodness.
And for a lot of reasons.
Yeah, right.
And then they'd turn on the radio and they'd hear their voice singing a song, and it's a group that didn't sing it who are listed, given credit for being the singers.
Well, that's Darlene Love's whole story, and it just shocked me that, you know, the lengths that people went just to rip these people off. It's horrible.
It's really the old sort of freelancer, you know, you go in, you do some work, you don't understand how valuable it will be or could be, and then they kind of purchase it and it's theirs and you're the one driving the song. I mean, it's that if people listen hard enough, you know, there's the singers who are not the great singers like Madonna.
Yeah.
Thank God for backup singers for Madonna.
No, but there are singers who are great singers.
Right.
Yes.
I mean, Sting, and that we mentioned again yesterday, mm-hmm. Sting from Springsteen,
right.
Stevie Wonder,
right.
Mick Jagger, mm-hmm. maybe not a great singer, but a full huge something singer. Every one of them, I thought, spoke so eloquently of those
and
people
truthfully,
back there about
yes.
how critical it was. I thought Springsteen in particular talked about it's not just 20 feet, it's miles from the back of the stage to the front of the stage, but how critical these people are.
And giving them their due. I loved it. And just that end of the Mary Clayton story when she went in and sang it the first time and they're like, oh my God, that's so good. And then she said, okay, now I'm really going to blow it out.
I'm all warmed up.
And they were totally shocked.
Yeah, and there are a ton, for those who didn't catch us yesterday, there are a ton of women then and now who are profiled. There's a lot of great video of them singing and interacting with leaders of some of the bands whose front people you obviously know. And then people, what is her name? Judith Hill? Is that the woman's name? Who the contemporary woman who, I think it was Judith Hill.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
Wasn't it?
Oh,
yeah.
Yes. And if people haven't seen actually the Michael Jackson film mm-hmm. that was done after
this
death,
is
this
it.
It, you really get a chance to see her. And I didn't put it together when I first saw her in mm-hmm. 20 Feet from Stardom. And boy, just hearing her whole story was fascinating too.
And she was, a critical piece of this tour that, as we all know, was what, weeks away?
Yes. Yeah.
From happening.
You know, Sheryl
Crow
used to be Michael
That's
Jackson's
right.
backup singer.
Is that so?
Well.
That's right.
There are so many that, you know, it's definitely a career path choice as well, because you do get to have a somewhat normal life. And the musicians in the band generally look, they used to call them the real singers. You know, I was actually on the road with Sting. I know, don't, relax.
Oh, wow.
Relax.
You were?
I was, yeah.
Were you a groupie or something?
I worked for A&M Records. I was like, groupie.
Yeah. Wow,
But, you know, these are the, they show up and they deliver and, when people improvise, they have to keep, you know, they're
right
working.
It. Yeah.
It's an amazing gift.
Yeah, but when you're standing, as they say, 20 feet from stardom, you're making whatever you make, a decent mm-hmm. life. The guy in front's making $1 million, whatever it is. And you say to yourself, as Murray mm-hmm. Clay, I mean, all of them were grown-ups, I should say, despite some regrets. You say, I sing at least as well as he or she does, probably better. But I've never.
Well, that's what I'm thinking right now about you, Jim. And
well, you know what? Somebody used to always say to me, and actually it was articulated in the movie, that there's a million, not a million, but at least 100 other Aretha Franklins. But for all of these various circumstances, which they lay out in the movie, you know, you just don't hear about them, or they never rise to the place that Aretha Franklin got to. So that's
well, on
amazing.
That note, we were going to end, but I should say Lisa Fisher is Aretha Franklin.
Yes,
and
let's,
here's a minute of Lisa Fisher, who most of you probably never heard of, nor had I, in the spirit of full disclosure. Closure, singing a piece of Papa Was a Rolling Stone.
I heard Papa was a jack of all trades. Zep said Papa to an early grave. Folks said Papa would beg, borrow, steal to pay his bills.
You know, some listeners are probably saying, are you going to talk about this movie every day? The answer is yes. Every guest who has seen it, we are going to talk to them about it.
Because
you cannot not. You talk to anybody who didn't love this movie or saw
nobody.
It. You can't leave it.
I went with my grumpy friend, and she was like, finally, a movie I like.
I'm a grumpy friend. And I just,
see, there you go.
You smile. I mean, even though there's a lot of pain, too, it is an incredible story. Speaking of great stories and speaking of movies, you also were lucky enough to see a movie that's not out yet that everybody's talking about. CNN had a huge piece on it this morning.
You must.
The
must.
Butler. Tell us about
you
it.
You must see The Butler.
Where'd you see it, by the way? How'd you see it?
I saw it at the National Association of Black Journalists Convention, where we often have early screenings of films, and also a Q&A with the director, Lee Daniels, Forrest Whitaker, and also Will Haygood. And, you know,
who wrote the original piece in the Washington Post
piece,
that this is based on?
I can't say enough about Will Haygood. He is one of the finest writers ever. And for him to finally get his due in this huge way, I'm so thrilled. And he's very humble as well.
What's the story for those who don't know?
All right. So the story is about Eugene Allen. His name is changed for the film to something else, but his real name is Eugene Allen. He was a butler in the White House for 8 presidents, beginning with Truman and ending with Reagan. And so through him, Lee Daniels, the director, saw an opportunity, and through Will's story as well, and that's what Will chronicled, you can see the march of history, the march of American history, the march of Black history, but from a particular vantage point. The movie has everything for everybody, I think. If you're just interested in what goes on behind the scenes in the White House, there's a little of that. There's certainly the whole wonderful evolution of the civil rights movement. For the first time, hear me, I'm the one who chronicled Eyes on the Prize, done correctly.
By the way, she did. People think that's a rhetorical statement.
You know, no.
She did and got the awards that deserved to come with it.
So if Gally says it's right, it's right.
Done. I cannot believe it's done so well. I said to Lee Daniels, you know, people are going to think this, you're just making up everything.
Right.
Because he has fictionalized characters at the heart of it who do some of this in contrast with what's going on in the White House. So you get a chance to see both of it. And then also what he manages to do, which is what makes it entertaining for people who are thinking, I can't go see a movie about civil rights. Oh, God. It's a love story, really, about a father and a son, and generational love story, which anybody can relate to about some of the things that tear sons and fathers apart. In this case, it was what was
going
on. Well,
it's also about the burden of the next generation.
Absolutely.
You know, and I think that everyone, you know, can relate to that, that you're, you know, my dad was a truck driver. My mom was a homemaker for a while. And to not be proud of that, you know, and not until you get older. And this is a story of, you know, a dad doing his part in a big way now, see. But the son, you know, not feeling that pride.
Not feeling the pride and not understanding and all of us getting a bird's eye view about the contrast of what was going on outside of that White House and what was going on in, and how one man could just hold this in and do his job and did it very well.
My daughter had, we saw a preview of it. My daughter had an amazing reaction to just the preview where she said, I don't think we can go see that. And I said, why? She said, because that's awful. I can't believe that happened in America, and I can't see it. And I'm like, well, history is going to be a long road for you.
You know, Kelly, you said a minute ago, you know, for people who said, I want to see a movie about civil rights, but whether it's coincidence or the fact that obviously this is the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington, which I did the math this morning, is 12 days after this movie is released to the general public on August 16th, there are a ton of movies coming out. I mean, Oprah Winfrey's in this movie. She's got her own movie coming out that deals with civil rights issues. Does she not?
I don't know about that. I just know that she does a fantastic performance.
She plays the wife?
The wife of Cecil Gaines. That's the fictionalized name of Eugene Allen in the movie. She's really good. Just here's a little tidbit that I think will fascinate people. There are 6 Oscar winners and about 19 Oscar nominees in this movie. People fought to get in it. So there are people like Robin Williams with 2 scenes. Jane Fonda has two scenes, and they wanted to. Lenny Kravitz canceled a tour to play a butler.
Ask this woman about Lenny Kravitz right now.
There you go.
And he does an excellent job. It's really, it's entertaining. You learn a lot. And take a hanky, because the son and father story is just so touching. That it will get to. I defy you to go there.
The
and
New
I
York
get
Times piece, it speaks about the interview with Oprah and Forrest talking about the notes she gave about the how to be authentic about where people were in that time.
Exactly.
You know, how explaining how big the assassination of John F. Kennedy was, you know, and just making sure that it's authentic to the time and the people who are doing it.
And I just want to add one thing about for journalists and those of us who are in the business. This is a story about what shoe leather journalism looks like. I'm serious.
I know.
Because if Will got this guy, he had been trying to find someone who could represent this era to contrast with Barack Obama's election. This was the 57th call, and he finally got him. And the relationship that he built to get him to talk to him, because his whole job was not to talk about what happened in the White House.
How old is Hager?
He's about late 40s, early 50s.
Is that all?
Somewhere.
Really?
Yeah.
So it comes out, I checked it out again, August 16th, and it's another thing about which everybody is
I can't say enough about
totally
it. You'll really enjoy it. People will really enjoy it.
This is Kelly Crossley, movie reviewer, by the way, I should say.
Don't walk.
Now,
that's what I say.
From the arts to, I guess, more on the ground, what's the under-the-radar chief story on Sunday night?
You know, this is a sign of the times, as we're still in an economic recovery, but boy, some of this stuff is very painful. So some people may have heard that last week, six Shaw's supermarkets announced they were closing in New Hampshire, as well as six Stop and Shop. So that's 12 grocery stores closing in New Hampshire. So you say, well, okay. Well, that's almost 1,100 people out of work. I mean, it's such an impact that Governor Maggie Hansen has asked people to ask the rapid response team to intervene from the Department of Revenue and Economic Development to try to figure out how to help these people land and find their feet. But here's the under-the-radar piece of it, because you're thinking that's bad enough, all right? Well, the food banks.
Yeah.
The food banks rely on that food, which is still good, but can be, you know, used again from all of these grocery stores.
What they say, a 500,000 pounds a year or something?
500 pounds of food.
500,000 pounds.
500,000 pounds of food going away.
From these supermarkets.
From these supermarkets alone. And then you think that the double irony, if can be such a thing, is that some of the people who are now losing their jobs may be in need of the food that these food banks serve, and because they're out of work, and God knows. So it's just one of those things that just hits you, you know, right where you live, and you think about, you know, but for the grace of God go I. But you don't think about all the other reverberations. So it's the food banks. The food banks are asking for people to, you know, give cash contributions if they can. But just to understand that this is not a small thing, and nor did it just happen to the people who were being let go from these grocery stores. I mean, there's just a bigger impact.
Are they close to it? I mean, you mentioned Maggie Hassan. I have to say, she's only been governor for less than a year. I'm pretty impressed by her.
Yeah.
Is anything happening, or it's all talking state? Well, obviously, were announced.
I thought it was pretty. I didn't even know there was such a thing as a rapid response team to begin with. Mm-hmm. So, you know, kudos to New Hampshire for having that. And she asked them to get right on it to figure out how they can work with these 1,100 people who are suddenly jobless. And as I said, may be in need of the services of a food bank. With regard to the food bank, all they can do is say, hey, you know, understand 500,000 pounds of food just went out of our shelves. So whatever you can do to help, and people are really in need of that help.
Yeah, I'm embarrassed. Yeah. I mean, I thought about the job impact and the impact to the local community, you know, I hadn't even thought of the impact it would have to
That's why Kelly's here, Bob.
I know. She does a good job.
That's the whole point.
Yeah,
she's not so bad. So it's 6:30 Sunday night, Under the Radar with Kelly Crossley.
That's right.
On WGBH.
That's right, Jim.
We'll be looking forward to it.
Right,
we're going to see The Butler, and if you haven't seen 20 Feet from Stardom, you've heard it from everybody. Okay, what did you say a minute ago?
What?
Run, don't walk.
No, Kelly said it.
Oh, she said it, whatever it is.
There you go.
Kelly, thanks.
All
great to see you.
Thank you.
Well, just when the courtroom drama surrounding the Whitey Bulger trial started to simmer down, defense attorney Jay Carney added some flair yesterday, telling the press pool that he gets a pedicure, and if that wasn't colorful enough, he went on to say that his toes are polished with an eggplant-colored veneer. Men and Their Pedicures is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Sue O'Connell again, sitting in for, well, not again, still sitting in for Marjorie Egan. We'll be back on Monday, and I am Jim Browdy. You know, anybody who's been paying attention to the Whitey Bulger trial, and incidentally, if you're wondering, there's no jury verdict, or you would hear it here live immediately. Well, you won't hear the verdict because there are no microphones or cameras in the courtroom, but you will hear us report it. You know that Bulger himself has been described as vain, from his eating habits to his fitness regime. The man puts a premium on how he looks, and as it turns out, so does defense attorney J.W. Carney. The way we know this, as Sue mentioned, during yesterday's hurry up and wait time at the Bulger trial, one reporter complimented the lead defense attorney, J.W. Carney, on his purple tie. In response, this is true, Carney took off a shoe and a sock to expose matching toenails, which were, as Sue said, eggplant purple, which of course raises the issue of men and pedicures. We want to know if you're for them, against them. Has Carney upped the mani-pedi ante, or is this what 21st century male grooming looks like? Have you gotten one? Would you get one? And if you did, would bright colors adorn your toes just like they do Carney's? The number is 877-301-8970. Men can call to tell the truth about themselves, and women can call to talk about the men they know in their lives. This is a pretty recent phenomenon.
You know,
is it
you
not?
Straight people crack me up.
Why is that?
You know,
for what number of reasons?
Well, your love of porn, number one, but that's not what we're talking about. Number two, a man puts on a little bit of, you know, makeup or makes his feet look pretty. I mean, who wants, first of all, most men. And yes. I'll speak in a generalization.
I'll speak for the rest of
the men. We don't want to see your feet, okay, with your toenails and your calluses. You take no care of
your
feet.
Tell that to Anthony Weiner, by the way. I'm serious.
Then you get into bed, you know, and it's awful. I know this from my straight housewife friends in Canton, okay, number one. So you have a man who takes care of his feet, and he puts a little color on. Gender expression is protected here in the state of Massachusetts. We shouldn't be making fun of him for just a little bit
of flair. I think it's great. If I'm making fun at all, the fact that in the middle of this high-pressure trial that he's taken off his shoes and socks to show people his feet, I mean, the reporters seemingly loved it. And to continue the story, by the way, he apparently gets a pedicure once a month.
Right.
When he first got a pedicure, I can't remember what he said. They said, do you want your toenails buffed or clear polish? And he said, I don't want it either. I want what those women have. I want a bright color. The first time was bright red. He now goes once a month. This is J.W. Carney. And apparently chooses another bright color every single month.
It's a conversation starter.
It is.
And by the way,
for those who think, Tori, one of our interns, pulled up this great thing. At Karen Allen Salon and Spa in Riverside, California. You ever been there, Sue?
No, I haven't.
Fine. Renaming the women's pedicure the executive pedicure proved so popular with men, the salon offers a men's only night during the summer featuring, you ready for this, barbecue and beer, along with services like pedicures, manicures, and facial. It's coming. What high-profile person in Massachusetts regularly has a pedicure? I'm not outing him about this because he said it on my prior
Deval
radio
Patrick.
Show. Deval Patrick, mm-hmm. as a matter of fact.
Because he's a gentleman.
He is a
gentleman. You know, this is also an issue of personal grooming. Like, at some point, I think Bill Maher said this, at some point, straight men gave up the idea of being a gentleman and just let gay men take off with the personal grooming. Mm-hmm. I mean, the idea that you would take care of yourself, if you look at the Los Angeles Hollywood crowd, all those men that are working in those big, they have their nails polished, they get their eyebrows waxed.
But they have 42 assistants. We're talking about mortals as opposed to people.
You can't swing a dead cat without seeing a nail salon. Really.
That
I mean,
is true.
When I was growing up and you were growing up, the nail salon was a big deal, right?
Yes, that's true.
But now you can't walk 2 feet without go in, spend the $32, make your wife happy.
If anybody has swung a dead cat of late, you brought up the issue. 877-301-8970. So there are really two thresholds. One, a man and a pedicure. Is this sort of the norm now? And two, if you do the pedicure route, do you have the boldness of a J.W. Carney? I look at him totally differently. Do you not look at him totally differently?
I actually do.
He's sort of a buttoned-up guy with that perfectly – his beard is perfectly groomed,
well,
too.
Yeah,
full of himself completely. Remember the other day when he's talking with someone's challenging his closing argument? He says, I wrote the chapter of the Code of Professional whatever on –
Well, you have to have a lot of ego and chutzpah to have red toenails if you're a man.
No, excuse me. Purple.
Well, he's had red before.
Eggplant purple. 877-301-8970. And when you think about it for a minute – why not? I mean, other than the fact that it wasn't done 10 or 15 years ago, why not look as good and have it? You're going to wear a shirt that makes you look good, are you not? Mm-hmm. You're going to wear pants that make you look good.
Well, you know, other people
one of
would.
Us is.
You know?
Well, actually, my shirt's pretty nice today. Why not do the toes thing, too? 877-301-8970. By the way, if Sue or any of you asked me if I've had a pedicure and what color were my nails, I will consider answering the question. Okay. Let's start with Ryan. You're in Newton. You're on with Sue O'Connell and Jim Bradley. Hey, Ryan.
Hi, how you doing?
Excellent.
So first and foremost, I think that it's not a question of gay, straight, male, female. I think it's just like, you know, nearly past the 21st century, 2013, if a guy wants to paint his toenails, so what?
Amen.
There you go,
Amen.
Rain. There.
So
yep.
You do it, Ryan?
It absolutely does not matter. What was that?
Do you do it?
No, not personally. Not a fan. But, you know, if a friend of mine did, it wouldn't matter to me at all. It wouldn't matter if he was straight or gay or anything like that. He just wants his toenails to look a certain way.
Do you have a girlfriend, Ryan?
Not currently, no.
In the past, have your feet been an issue? I mean, you know, there's sort of a rule in beauty that if you're going to wear sandals or flip-flops, your feet should look presentable. I mean, do you have a nice pumice stone at home?
I take it about as far as the face for personal grooming. Everything else is just like, you know, I'll take a shower, but I don't really need to worry about a manicure.
From the neck down.
That's
right.
It.
Ryan's
it.
Great from the neck up. Ryan, thank you for your call. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970. This is a J.W. Carney-inspired conversation. Yesterday, nothing is happening at the trial, except in the jury room, of course, and he shows off a foot with eggplant mm-hmm. purple toenails. By the way, I can't believe
he
wasn't played up bigger than this.
Well, I mean, that's the other part of it. I mean, he had to. It's not just saying it. He actually had to show it.
Exactly. And another argument for cameras
in the courtroom.
Let's go to Ray and Weymouth. You're on with Sue and Jim. Hey, Ray.
Yeah, I regularly get both a manicure and a pedicure at Jay Spa in Abington.
Mm-hmm.
How long you been doing the pedicure end of that, Ray?
I get it with Crystal there too. She's the best.
Oh, okay. Hi, Crystal.
Probably 6-7 years.
And so you do the pedicure. What your toes look like post pedicure? Are they clear? Is it sort of that's the thing where they brush them, and so there's sort of a slight sheen, or are they colored?
No, they're not colored. The big thing is you have to make sure that you go to someone that knows what they're doing.
Well,
you know, they're really trained at it. Like the person that I go to, Crystal, she knows how to do the in-ground toenails.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
That Crystal, I'll tell you, she is amazing.
Ray, can I ask what you do for a living?
I'm a retired special investigator with the Massachusetts Department of Revenue.
Yeah, I totally
great.
See it. That's
now,
great.
By the way, Ray, why'd you laugh when I asked you if you were going to do a color thing like J.W. Carney? Why not?
She just seems crazy. I mean,
Ray, would you
You'll
wear,
get there.
Here's a question. Would you wear a little concealer if you needed it on your face, under your eyes, if you had some dark circles under your eyes? Would you, or are you drawn, it's just manicures and pedicures are it?
I might wear some concealer if I was, you know, going to some special event.
Like, I love
I got
Ray.
News for you. Colored toenails are in your future, I can tell, Ray.
It's a gateway makeup. It's a gateway makeup. Once you go to the manicurist and it's the pedicure, and before you know it, concealer under the eye.
Now, can I tell you, for those men out there who are saying to themselves, I was hoping we'd get a few men right away who would say, not me, not ever.
Mm-mm.
What people are not aware of is not only is the pedicure, I mean, the actual nail treatment and then the coloring are not the key. Every pedicure you get, which will give away the fact that I've had them, they do this incredible rubbing of your feet and calves that is to die for. I mean, I don't know if that
when people
were getting pedicures 20 years ago, was that part of the thing or they just did your nails?
You know, I can't remember, but I've only remembered it but it is a great experience. Oh. Plus, your feet look great. And I'm not kidding about being out in the summer with your ugly feet hanging out. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a personal grooming issue, you know?
You know, it's like J.W. Carney now, obviously a big-time lawyer here. Whether he wins, well, obviously he's going to lose at least most of this case, if not all this case. Every interview he does, probably for the next 10 years of his life,
talk about it.
One of the first questions someone like me is going to ask is, take them off.
And his obituary, right?
It is.
You're
going to
have two
is.
Things. You're going to have Bulger and the eggplant colored
exactly.
nails.
Exactly. It's not such a horrible thing to have in your obituary. Let's go to Providence, where Wes is on with Sue and Jim. We're talking male pedicures and coloring a la J.W. Carney. Hi there, Wes.
Hi. Good morning or good afternoon.
Hi.
I think there's an interesting dichotomy. On one hand, you have a certain view of manliness that's probably exemplified by Mad Men or James Bond, you know, guys looking good in their suits with good, tight haircuts. But then I've also dated quite a few girls who have a more rugged idea. And to mm-hmm. those girls, the thought of a guy getting a manicure and pedicure is not masculine in the attractive way that they want. and they don't want the hipster effeminate look. They would rather date, you know, someone with calluses on their hands.
That's a good point, Wes. You know, my one of my neighbors growing up, my mom's best friend, her husband was a mechanic. And, you know, he was a very neat guy, but he always had grease and oil under his fingernails. And his wife hated it. And my mother used to say to her, it shows he works for a living. You know, there is something about that badge of manliness.
And I have gotten manicures and pedicures done. I think the worst part about a pedicure is I have very ticklish feet. And I'm always worried I'm going to kick the girl who's working.
So you giggle like a girl while you're getting your pedicure.
I try not to giggle. Back to the subject of masculinity. But I get the buffing because it does look nice. And in all honesty, just like shaving, as a guy, it can be a chore or you can make it something more enjoyable. Like, you know, if you use a $5 disposable razor, different than if you're using a $200 straight razor.
Yeah, every few
Wes,
years,
you are really nailing it. I should say, I'm not at the straight razor phase, but I spend more than I need to on shaving cream. Because when you get high-quality shaving cream,
it makes all the difference.
It is the most luxurious feel, unless you're rushing because you had to be working 10 minutes. Wes, you nailed it. Thank you so much.
Every year
for the
I get my brother, not every year, but every few years, I get him that really expensive, you know, couple of $100 shaving kit.
And, you do?
And it makes, he has at least one nice thought about me a day.
Okay, Hanukkah's coming soon.
Okay, I got it. I'll get
right.
You seven of them.
Let's do Haley in Rhode Island. Haley, you're on Boston Public Radio. Thank you for the call.
Hi, I think that, quite frankly, somebody should tell him he needs to do every 2 weeks.
that Carney should get a pedi every 2 weeks.
I think he should go every 2 weeks because now polish is going to chip and those feet are going to get gross again. I think he should go every 2 weeks.
Now, are you being facetious or you're into this?
No, I'm young. I'm 19. And it could just be that I'm young, but I think it's great.
And assuming we go the extra step, which none of the men who are doing pedicures who've called us have been willing to take, the color thing, I assume, is fine with you, right?
I would laugh.
Yeah.
Laugh derisively or like with a little bit of shock? Or could you live with it if it was your boyfriend or you couldn't?
Oh, I would love it. I would think it was great and hilarious. I wouldn't take it seriously, but I think it would be great.
You know, it's sort of the
give Carney your number, Haley. Thanks so much.
It's sort of the male earring of this century. You know, remember last century, men would get earrings, one earring, and people would be all freaked out. This is what this is now.
Now, who is the guy who made the one earring acceptable in mainstream America?
Mr. Clean.
No.
No.
That was a ring. Ed Bradley on
Ed Braley,
60 Minutes. When people would look up, you know, it's one of those, how long has he been doing that ring thing?
Right.
And then you realize he looked totally fabulous. Yeah. And then they're coming.
Now you can tell how old someone is if they have, you know, just because the kids don't do it today.
Or you can just count the rings.
Yes.
You can do the, let's do one more.
All right.
Rhode Island, this is a huge topic. Nancy, you're on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for the call.
Hi, folks. I listen to your show as much as I can. I am a nail tech.
Oh, you are? Great.
And as much as you're having a great deal of fun with this, and I'm laughing right along with you, I do have men who come to me for pedicures. They range everywhere in age from 80 to 20. Some of them have back problems with football injuries, cannot bend. Some of them are legally blind. It's not safe for them to run and implement themselves. Some of them have war injuries and can't possibly run an implement, but I do have those who, along with their basic pedicure, clipping the nails, removing the calluses, do want color. I even had one young fellow who had a very, very nervous bride and asked me to mimic her pedicure on a QT so that he could show it to her just before she walked down the aisle and make her relax. And I've had people who've done not only color, but nail art right down to marijuana leaves and their pets and you name it.
You sound like an art. Hey, Nancy, does the 80-year-old do color or not?
I had one who did.
Good for him.
I had one who did, and I tell you what, I gave it to him for free just because he had so much moxie.
There
well, you know,
go.
80 is the new 20, Nancy.
Yes.
I think you know that. Nancy, thank you. We're going to take one more quick one. Steve from Marlboro, you're on with Sue and Jim. Hey, Steve.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
Afternoon.
Hi. What's up?
Yeah, I'm listening, and like I said, I'm a out and proud gay male, late 40s, but I think this is kind of the gayest thing I ever heard of.
Isn't it? Isn't it, Steve?
A little.
Wait, is that a good thing or a bad thing, Steve?
It's a good thing, but in an odd way.
I suppose. I had a mani-pedi once. I don't know. It was very uncomfortable for me. I'd rather take care of my stuff myself.
Are you one of those bear men? Are you part of the bear contingent?
No,
no, no. We just...
No, I'm not the bear guy. But,
okay.
Hey, Steve. Perfect capper on the conversation. Thank you so much for the call. So we hope after the trial, J.W. Carney will visit us. And by the way, as of the moment, in answer to your question, the jury has not returned. And it is
105. Oh, I thought we were going to talk about you already told us.
No,
okay.
I did. 105, and obviously the hours are running. What's up next?
Well, when we come back, it's time for Open Mic with Emily Rooney. So keep your dial right here on 89.7 WGBH for that conversation.
I'm reporter Ann Mastu. I live in Boston, and I bring you news from Boston.
Rob Vandermark is an owner at Ride Studio. He's troubled by the deaths of 5 cyclists in Boston and at least one outside the city this year.
I'm here because I'm passionate about finding the truth and giving voice to the people in our community.
I've been on country roads where I've had cars throw things at me. I've had country roads.
Ann Mastu, WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This program is made possible thanks to you and Grogan & Company Fine Art Auctioneers, assisting New England families with the sale of their fine art, antiques, silver, and jewelry since 1988, located in historic Dedham, Massachusetts, and at GroganCO.com. And Washington Week, the latest addition to WGBH's public affairs lineup. Friday nights, join Gwen Ifill and kick off an evening of lively debate and fresh insights. That's Fridays starting at 8 on WGBH 44.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. Sue O'Connell is sitting in for Marjorie, who will return on Monday. It is Friday. I've said it about 14 times. If it's Friday, it must be open mic with Emily Rooney, including the now legendary Emily's List. Hello, Emily Rooney.
Hey, Jim. Hey, Sue. How are you?
Hey, Emily. Good. So we had indictments in the Boston Marathon bombing. The two guys that were friends of the alleged bombers. You want to talk a little bit about?
Yeah, I'm going to actually try to pronounce their names. Yeah. So Diaz Karabayev and Azamat Tazahaya Kabov. All right, that's good enough.
These two guys, UMass Dartmouth kids.
19 years old. This is a gross overreach. Yes. Indicting these two. I mean, they are guilty of greed, being incredibly stupid and immature. But nothing more than that. And they're friends of his. He said, oh, go into my room, help me out. At that point, I think they did realize something was up, and he probably had been, he was somehow involved in the bombings. But, you know, they've been in jail all summer long. They've been in jail since sometime in April.
What could they possibly be trying to get or prove? I mean, I agree with you 100%.
Well, it's conspiracy charges at this point. I mean, they're looking at 25 years in jail. They've already spent enough time.
Wait a second. Enough time? You mean you think they've suffered enough this couple of months? Yeah. Since April, late April?
Yeah.
That's enough time?
According to
the indictment, it says in the Boston Globe today, I can't pronounce the names, one of them said to the other that he, the first one, believed Zahar Tsarnaev had used the Vaseline that was in his room to, quote, make bombs or words to that effect. This was just 5 hours after the FBI released the photos and videos. They knew with these guys.
Do you believe that? That's what the FBI says.
I don't know if I believe it or not. Well, these days,
I don't
want to believe. But the notion that if after the fact they tried to bury the evidence, literally bury the evidence, which in their minds could have caused Zahar Tsarnaev to have gotten away with this thing. It turns out it didn't. How can you say 3 months in jail is enough for these people?
It was just an impulsive act of stupidity.
What if they were 29 instead of 19? Would you feel the same way?
No, probably not.
I have one of my sources who's a Boston police detective. They've been calling these two the knuckleheads.
Yeah,
you know,
they
that's what they have been calling them. You know that they were stupid. They didn't understand the scope of what was happening, even as it was happening, even as we were all watching it unfold. That there was just some panic thing that went off in them.
Yeah, you know, the problem is when you say they're only 19, and I have to say I have some of the same reaction.
So is
Zahar Tsarnaev, only 19.
There's a difference to reacting to the news as you see it and trying to expand your brain that your friend did this.
Yeah.
I mean, I would say they should be in longer, but not...
No,
not.
Well, let's move... Since you brought up Tsarnaev and their two friends...
Don't we bring it up every week?
We do, because, by the way, since the authorities and politicians don't, I think it's one of our obligations. Todashev. Yes. We all know that this Ibrahim Todashev Kardashev is the guy in Florida, we'll repeat again, who allegedly was about to sign an admission that he and the older Tsarnaev were responsible for the triple murder in Waltham on the 10th anniversary of 9/11, the unsolved triple murder. And obviously the reason that matters is that had it happened at the time, had they arrested him, then obviously the older Tsarnaev arguably would have been in jail. After the FBI releases no information about what happened in that room where an FBI agent shot and killed him, all different stories about what weapon he had or didn't have, after the FBI refuses to allow the coroner in Florida to release the autopsy results, the ACLU in Massachusetts and Florida goes to their attorneys general and says, conduct your own investigations. Yeah. You had an Orlando cop in there. You had two Massachusetts state troopers. Martha Coakley, to my disappointment, our attorney general, says we have no jurisdiction. Yesterday, we found out the Orlando, Florida prosecutor says, yeah, I have the preliminary report from the FBI. I'm going to do my own investigation.
Yeah. And it has it doesn't matter what state it was in, just because it was in Florida, because it's a federal thing. But absolutely, and Martha Coakley should be looking into this.
Why do you think she's, in all seriousness, why is she not doing this?
Where's the outrage on this?
Well, especially since, as we've said before, we funded two state troopers to be in that apartment. No one knows if they were in the room at the actual time of the shooting.
We don't know anything. I mean, it's ridiculous.
I don't even know who was in the room. Were some other family members in the room? We don't know anything.
You know, I mean, this is the challenge of when we have lawmakers who are also law enforcers. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is like Attorney General Martha Coakley, is she going to play on the side of what law enforcement is doing and wants her to do, or is she going to represent the people? I mean, I think that's the conflict.
And for those who feel it's appropriate to say it's not our jurisdiction, the Globe has made the point, I think Maria Sacchetti, the writer, repeatedly, I think it was 2009, an imam was killed in Detroit. And in addition to the FBI investigation, the local authorities or the attorney general decided to do his or her own investigation. So it's not unheard of. It's not an aberration. And it's obviously pretty critical. As you said, do we know he had a weapon or not? Do we know if he really was about to confess? Do we know if he had something to do with the marathon? We know nothing, as you say. And I agree. I think Coakley should get involved. Okay, from the sublime to the ridiculous. I hesitate to bring up. Saturday and Sunday, a lot of people are going to be stuffing microwaves in their cars and refrigerators.
Things they don't need.
It's this absurd sales tax holiday. I think we've had it every year for years except for one. Are you in favor of this?
I'll tell you why it's absurd. It doesn't go far enough.
Tell me why. It should include automobiles. Is that what you're going to say?
Cars. Yeah. You got to include things that are worth $100,000. Anything. You know, mink coats. Come on. What's the point of having this if it's a
there's a $2,500 limit for those who don't know.
You can buy more than one item for $2,500.
Yeah. Yes, you got to go back in line. I agree with both of you. I mean, I think it's absurd because, you know, I have very intelligent people who look at me and go, I'm going to go get that toaster oven. I'm like, wow, you're going to save 15% of $20.
Excuse me, 6.25%. Yes.
And at the same time, it should be, if it were larger, you would really generate sales. And it's good, you know.
Yeah, but excuse
cars
me.
Should be included.
And it gives she's small appalled.
People have been keeping, there's a study last week that people are keeping their cars for 11 and a half years.
That's amazing.
Yours is probably 22 and a half.
So you misunderstood this.
132,000 miles.
How many?
132,000.
I have 120.
It's time to get a new car. Would you buy a new car this weekend if there was no sales tax?
Absolutely.
Wait a second. That is the most insane thing. Excuse me.
$3,000.
Can I talk to her for a second, please, Emily? Okay, so your new car is going to cost you $40,000. Mm-hmm. Let's pick $40,000.
Oh, boy.
No, it's $40,000. Right. So what you just said to Emily Rooney is I'm not going to buy a new car. But if we're able to get $2,400 off, which is what the 6 point, I'll buy something for $40,000 that I couldn't have afforded because I'm getting $2,400 off. It's ridiculous.
Well, if you could afford it, I mean, if you're smart.
But if you could afford it, you'd buy it anyway. The sales, all it does is cost the state $20 million that we
can't afford.
What do you mean they can afford it?
This is what it generates in goodwill from businesses that they can you know hit with some kind of fee later. Yeah. It all evens out.
I would like to know, have you ever purchased anything? I'm talking to Emily Rooney now on sales tax free weekend.
I don't buy anything on sale.
Yeah.
Period.
There's too many people. The people are out there. We
full
don't
retail
want to be
kind of gal.
Can I vent for one more second about the absurdity of this? Not only do people all they do is postpone purchases so they can make it this weekend.
No, they don't.
Secondly, of course they do.
That's what they do all the time anyway.
Secondly, Emily, here's the ad in the newspaper. Buy a new car at so-and-so Toyota. Save 6.25%. How many people you know are going to say, what? Save 6%? I'm going to run. No one's going to run there. 50% someone would run for. It's just not enough.
You'd be surprised. Listen, I think people would it would really in car sales, I think it would really generate some
action. You need some sort of hook for August. It's all about back to school. If you don't have any kids going back to school and you want to avoid the stores, you need some sort of hook.
Right. If Emily's right, if she were in charge of the laws in the state, you could buy every kid a new car.
Exactly.
Okay, enough of this. This is really why you turn in. You turn in for this.
Incomprehensible. It's out of control. How about common sense? Doesn't matter. Why not? This is the kind of thing that drives people crazy. It's your right. Doesn't matter. I have absolutely no interest.
I got an email from Janice this morning who said, do you know in advance? Are you just playing along what Emily's list will include? And the answer is no. What's on this week's list, Emily?
Well, you know how Marjorie always says, oh, it's not complaints, it's observations?
Yes.
That's not right this week.
So what do you got?
The first part of my list is just irritants, things that I'm either sick of or I'm irritated about. I've decided that I'm sick of this discussion about who should vote about the casino. The truth of the matter is nobody should vote. The legislators, you know, decided that we're going to have casinos and that this commission that we put together with some very capable people are going to decide where they are. We didn't get to vote on the BU Biolab. What neighborhood voted on that?
Good point.
So forget this. End of discussion. Nobody gets a vote. Okay, you with me?
No, I'm not with you at all.
I
think there should have been a statewide referendum
today
on casinos before the law went into place.
I didn't get to vote on that BU Biolab.
Well, you should. The fact you didn't, maybe the solution is to allow people to have direct votes on things that affect
their everything.
People don't need direct vote. We have people we have voted for to make those decisions.
That's
okay,
right.
Fine,
they already made it.
You.
I wouldn't have voted for the casinos, okay, but since they did, that's fine. All right. I'm sick of and irritated by any mention of West Nile virus. This is one of those things, and it's in the paper every day.
We found one mosquito.
We found a mosquito. It's like, remember SARS from like 10 years ago?
Oh, yeah.
Everybody was afraid. They were going around with the little masks on and everything. Like, everybody's going to die of SARS. No one did. And I know a couple of people have gotten EEE and that, but it's like, it's not a raging phenomenon.
Well, you know why it's even more unbelievable? Every year when it comes up, there's somebody who bravely publishes that. What is it? Like 20,000 people die every year from the flu.
A lot
and we're not
that,
going, whatever it is, we're not going crazy about that.
Yeah, we don't go crazy about
Why do we go crazy? Do you remember the great, speaking of things that didn't happen, what was the name of it when Gerald Ford was president? Was it the swine flu? Do you remember the Chevy Chase who used to play Gerald Ford on Saturday Night Live? When Gerald Ford would be in a debate or being president, he'd always have a syringe going through his jacket pocket for the swine's flu vaccine.
But
we agree with you on
that. I don't agree. Aren't we preventing it, though? I mean, are we preventing it?
No.
I mean, we're spraying, we're killing mosquitoes. Who can be against killing mosquitoes?
You're not going to be able to kill all the mosquitoes.
No.
There's a lot more mosquitoes this year because of all the rain we've had.
Yeah, so we should kill them.
I'm just sick of the fear mongering over it.
Fine.
All right, I have one more. And then I've got a list.
Really
I've got a list of phenomena this week also. This is my list of irritants. All right.
Yes.
Every year this one comes up, and sure enough, you know, today I think it's tonight the NFL preseason starts
tonight.
The Eagles.
Okay, so Slate.com has decided they are not going to ever use the term Redskins again. That's the name of the Washington NFL team. They're not going to use it because they don't approve
so
of
it.
So
what are they going to call them, the team from Washington?
Yep.
Well, let's go to the underlying issue. I hope you don't like the fact that Dan Snyder allows his team to be called the Redskins.
That's what the name of the team
no,
is.
No, but I understand. Should they?
It.
Why can't they change
they
it?
Can't. It's that's who it is. It's fine. I'm not I can't believe that there's widespread offense taken over this, except for maybe you two right here.
Yeah, you're offended. Tell me you're offended.
Of course I am. I mean, that's the whole point of when you're a minority. If there were widespread offense, it's called white, you know, majority. You know, and when white majority.
If you really go back and, you know, there's a lot of debate about how this whole got going and whether it was originally a pejorative. And I know pejorative changes over the years. Negro didn't used to be a pejorative, and now it is. And, you know, same with Redskins, but it's the name of the team.
Okay, you're irritated.
Yeah, I'm irritated.
Okay.
All right.
So just don't go to salon.com. Now, you're going from irritants to what are you going to?
Phenomena. Okay.
Phenomena.
Like phenomena.
It's phenomena, by
now,
the way.
Phenomena. All right, so I thought I was onto something a couple of months ago, and now I know I am.
Good.
People are painting their hubcaps.
Oh.
In flat colors. Not shiny colors, but flat colors.
Really?
But flat neons like pink and purple and this awful green.
Oh, I've seen it. You're right.
It's like, why?
Were you upset about that or what? If they want to do it, it's their car. What do you care about?
I know.
Well, can I tell you something? If Marjorie was here, you would say, she would say Jim Browdy's brilliant business idea that never came to fruition. I believe that the business should be created is to shrink wrap cars.
Ooh.
So that you could the fact that we don't design our cars, there are no patterns.
Well, I'm not irritated by this.
Oh, you're not.
I'm just
observing.
Saying it's an observing. This is
a phenomenon.
I'm observing that people are printing.
Do they have those big fat tires too? Those wide ones? Are they painting those hubcaps?
I think you are irritated by this.
It's puzzled.
No, puzzled.
And, all right, here's another one. Here's another phenomenon I'm puzzled about.
Okay,
did you guys know about this thing? That kids, teenagers, for the most part. So I'm playing tennis the other day, and there's this phone on the table there, and it smashed to smithereens, and all the little shards of glass are. This is what kids do. This is a phenomenon. Kids
smash. You mean like this phone?
Yeah. Why?
Well, because it's.
She's held up her.
No, they do it intentionally.
Well, it started out that they have backpacks or back covers that they can put on it that look like it's smashed, but it also shows that these phones are much more indestructible, and it's sort of a badge of honor.
Why do you want to do that?
I don't know why the kids do it. I just do it so I can have
a
conversation.
Wait a second.
You did it on purpose?
This appears to go beyond puzzlement to irritation. Am I correct? Or what are you?
Well, if I were the kid's mother, I'd be irritated.
Would be.
Because,
that's a great one, Emily.
All right. I have one more.
Oh, good.
Did you know, Jim, that...
Wait, which category is this again?
This is phenomenal.
Phenomena. Okay.
There's nothing that turns me on more than a guy who uses a pepper grinder.
Wow.
What do I have on my desk upstairs?
Every morning. It's like
are you mocking me
or
not?
No, I like it.
He puts pepper
on what? I question.
Your coffee?
I question what he's putting it on.
Yeah.
Because half the time it's like, can I say it? Isn't it like one of those McDonald's things?
It's like a breakfast sandwich.
How big is it?
Frozen breakfast sandwich.
How big is your pepper grinder?
Can I tell you, since she brought it up, and if I may... To make it even sexier, not only do I have a pepper grinder here at Chief Ridge, and not only do I have a pepper grinder at NECN. You ready for this?
Yeah.
I have two pepper grinders, one white pepper, one black pepper, in my car in the console.
I knew I was onto something. So when I go through a drive-thru,
I pause, I pull to the side,
so look,
I pause, I do that, the crunching
I
sound
love
is
the
great.
Sound.
How
it's
great is the sound?
I love it.
It's unbelievable. Thank you.
But so guys aren't often into pepper.
Yeah.
So this
do you go through
you.
Like
really
a drive-through McDonald's and you're putting fresh pepper on it?
I'm a salter.
Yes. Yeah.
Do you salt too?
I don't eat
I like the salt.
Salt.
I like the
But by the way, if I did salt, I'd grind it too.
Yeah, I like to grind the salt.
This is, by the way, one of my proudest moments in our almost 6 years at GH.
You're turned on and you're glowing.
That's
great.
What a way to end. Look at the smile on her face, my face.
I'm speechless.
I'm serious. Grinding pepper is the path to salvation.
I got to watch that.
Emily
Rooney
will see you. Oh, well, great ball.
Tonight.
Beat the Press. What's
going on? Well, we think, and this is a verdict in the
obviously.
Yeah.
What's
great?
What is Beat the Press? You know,
well, we've got the Washington Post and the Boston Globe, and we've got to, you know, look at the sales of those two giant papers and two relative novices in
great.
The newspaper business.
We'll be watching. Emily Rooney, thanks so much. That's 7 o'clock tonight.
Bye,
Beat the Press. See you. Bye.
Emily Rooney, every Friday right here at 1 o'clock. Of course, you can get her tonight at 7 on Greater Boston. You know the old adage, the customer is always right. Well, when it comes to online behavior, that's not exactly the case. The conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
In 10 years from now, we're going to see tens of millions of buildings all over the world producing their own green power. And in 20 years, we're going to see several hundred million existing and new buildings on Earth producing their own green electricity.
And he's been right before. I'm Tara Miller, an in-depth look at green energy and our economy with forward-thinking energy expert Jeremy Rifkin on Innovation Hub, Saturday morning at 10, here on WGBH Radio.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Tanglewood, presenting the Tanglewood Wine and Food Classic with renowned chefs, taking place August 15th through 18th, grand tasting August 17th. More information available at tanglewood.org.
And Sullivan Tire and Auto Service. All Massachusetts stores are open for the Massachusetts sales tax holiday this Saturday and Sunday, offering brand name tires and parts for over 56 years. More at SullivanTire.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. Sue O'Connell is sitting in for Marjorie Egan. New research out of MIT brings, I guess, good news for business and bad news for consumers. It turns out there's online inflation, not when it comes to prices necessarily, but when it comes to ratings. Joining us to explain is MIT's Sinan Aral. He's an expert in social networking and social media, and he co-authored a recent paper on this topic for Science. Sinan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So basically, when I'm, you know, looking at the Yelp and looking at online reviews, and I see that there's a lot of positive reviews or a lot of negative reviews, I can't just trust the crowd. Is that what you're saying?
Well, it turns out that we've got so many social signals today. I mean, you're right. We've got Yelp reviews and Netflix reviews, and we hear what people like on Facebook and so on. And so we were really interested in just that question, can you really trust it? What do these social signals do to our decision-making and our perceptions of value? And what we found is that there's some inflation on the positive side, and we had to do a very large-scale experiment to get to that answer.
You know, one of my I haven't, I think, consciously inflated something, a review, but I have held back from expressing a negative review about something that
everyone... Why, because you felt bad for the business or something?
No, it was more I just didn't want to be a fly in the ointment. I mean, I didn't know that what I had was so valuable. But
you know, Sinan, let me just be clear. For people who haven't read either the Globe story or don't understand, what you're saying is that if you encounter, you're about to do a review, and you'll obviously correct me if I'm wrong, and you see a positive review or two before yours, yours is likely to be more positive than you may actually feel about the service or product or hotel or whatever. Is that correct?
That's exactly what we found.
And
we
why?
Found,
what is that?
Well, it's funny. We were also curious as to why this was the case, and we didn't go and interview people and sort of grab them by the lapels and say, what were you thinking? You know you were going to give a 3 and now you gave a 4. But what we found in a large-scale experiment is we randomly manipulated votes at the very beginning and just gave a single positive upvote or a single positive downvote to randomly chosen items. And what we found was that there was a 32% increase in the next viewer's likelihood of voting positive on seeing a positive manipulation, which resulted in a 25% increase in the mean rating of those items. And that's a pretty significant inflation. So exactly as you stated, if you see a positive review, you're more likely to give one, holding your own perception of the item constant.
Now, you know that this has more than just, you know, how the pizza place down the corner is going to do. This also, our behavior, which I think you call herding, has a lot to do with our creating bubbles, like the housing bubble and other things that we sort of drive up with our inspirational positivity.
I think so. I mean, I don't want to extend the generalization too far, but this is an example of herding behavior, which we have seen in lots of different crises in just the last year or two. And before talking about that, I'd say that even online reviews, I think, are quite important, but for two reasons. Number one, they're one of the cornerstones of consumer confidence in e-commerce research. Nielsen indicates that 2/3 of people see reviews as accurate and trust them, up 15% from last year, and that it's the number two source for valuable information on how to make e-commerce decisions next to friends and family. And so we just had a baby. We chose doctors, and we used reviews to determine which doctors to interview. And so I think these are really important factors online. But offline, the same type of herding behaviors might explain why somebody will pay more for a house than they're willing to just because the people around them have been paying more for houses in the last week or last month. I'm currently sitting in New York City, and we certainly see a lot of that going around today.
You know, we're talking to Sinan Aral from MIT's Sloan School of Management. He published the findings he's describing in the journal Science. You know, before I read the piece, I saw the headline. My analysis, totally anecdotal, was it would be the exact opposite, that it's only totally, it's sort of like Marjorie Egan, who's not here today, who's a columnist for The Herald, my co-host, and I talk on the air and off a lot about the comments that people put after stories in The Globe, The Herald, and all these newspapers, overwhelmingly and wildly negative. And you can see it's sort of the stereotype of the guy living in his mother's basement when he's 47 years old. Didn't you enter with the same notion that negative feelings about something were more likely to provoke you to sit down and write than positive feelings?
You know, I would have, at the very minimum, thought that they would be equal. But what we found was exactly the opposite, that the positive feelings snowball and create this herding effect and positive inflation, but the negative feelings have no effect. And so it may be that although there are lots of negative comments on the website or on the review, that the question we're answering is, what does that do to people's perception of the item that's being commented on or voted on? And what we find is that those negative comments have less of an effect on your own beliefs than the positive ones.
You know, let me give you a hypothetical and tell me how you feel about this person, Sinan, if you can. Let's assume a guy is eating in a restaurant in New York City and he wants to leave a review on Yelp. And he intended to award a 3-star rating, but he saw that the last review had rated the restaurant much higher and praised the prices and salad dressing, so he chose 4 stars instead. What would you say about that person?
That guy's a genius.
Who is that guy, Sinan?
So in fact, that happened to me.
I know that.
This allusion is only a veiled reference to myself, obviously. So I was actually eating in a restaurant in New York, and I went to give the Yelp review afterwards, and I had it in my mind that this was, you know, I had just experienced it. I had been there, I had eaten there, I had experienced the service myself. I had a pretty good idea of what I thought of the place, and I thought it was average. On average, I thought it was average, and so I was going to give it a 3. And right as I went to the page where it says click to rate, this was the Yelp website. On the right hand side of the web page, on the right hand column, was a 5-star review by a woman who was waxing poetic about how delicious the salad dressing was and how great the food was for the price, which reminded me that, yeah, you know, actually for the price it wasn't bad. And
that's great.
And you know, she was very convincing, so I gave it a 4.
Okay, Sinan, do you have someone with the same name who teaches at NYU's Stern School of Business?
No, I actually have just switched jobs.
You were there though, right?
That's correct.
Okay, one of our producers just printed out your ratings from the students. Can I share them with the listeners, please?
Absolutely, please.
Go ahead. Areas like helpfulness, clarity, easiness, all the good things, your overall quality on a scale of 0 to 5 was 4.9.
Wow.
So should we assume, based on your research, that you are a 4.9
or really
maybe like a 3.7?
Yeah, I was going to say 4.5.
I'm serious. And people read positive reviews and they got into the spirit and they inflated your ratings.
Absolutely. So I have a very, very solid answer to that one. The students do not see each other's reviews when they rate. So that is a precisely accurate number.
You know, Sinan, one last serious thing from me, and it's touched upon in the Globe piece. We should say who wrote it, by the way. Carolyn Johnson wrote the piece in the Globe.
Yes, an excellent writer for the Globe.
She is. And you know, we've talked about these kind of ratings before and how obviously the ability of a business owner to manipulate it by getting a friend or something or under a pseudonym, putting a posting, obviously can affect things. But it's even more the case if you can get a handful of people to post positive things about your business. And obviously there's the other side. People angrily do negative things, can destroy your business. If you get people to post a handful of positive things every once in a while, the likelihood, based on your research, is that other people are going to buy into the mentality and they essentially manipulate ratings on their own business.
Absolutely. So one of the scary thoughts that come out of these results is that there is a clear incentive for manipulation for the businesses, because they get a greater than marginal improvement in their ratings. By one rating, they can improve by 25% the average rating. And so one of the takeaways is that now design science has to take this the next step and say, how do we design these collective intelligence systems or these wisdom of crowd systems to avoid these types of biases? And, you know, I had an idea. So, for instance, maybe Yelp could not show me that rating while I'm rating my while I'm giving my own rating. Now, the trouble with that, the sort of practical hurdle to that, is that Yelp and other websites want people to have the ratings for their decision-making whether or not they rate. So you shouldn't have to unlock the ratings by rating yourself. You should be able to peruse all the ratings. Actually, 6 months after we first publicly presented these results, and I can't say whether this is correlation or causation, Reddit changed its policy. And what they did was, instead of showing the scores immediately, they waited some period of time and accumulated a number of votes and then showed the score. And they wrote on their website that this was specifically to avoid this type of hurting behavior.
Hey, Sinanaral, based on this brief conversation, I'd give you a 4.9 also. Sinanaral, he's from MIT's Sloan School of Management. His findings appear in the journal Science. Sinan, thanks so much for your time. We appreciate
thanks
it.
Thanks for having me.
Thank Pleasure. You. Up next, it's our Friday news quiz, an experiment that tests what's happening. What happens when you book a guest. That's easy for me to say. Keep easy. Your dial on 89.7 WGBH.
Summertime. Shouldn't the living be easy? It can be when you become a WGBH sustainer. Here's how it works. You choose the amount to give, $10, $20, $30 a month, whatever works for you, and that's how much comes to WGBH each month. Plus, there's lots of benefits, like exclusive ticket offers, automatic renewal, oh yeah, and less on-air fundraising, because WGBH knows it can already count on your support. Become a sustainer online at WGBHnews.org and make your summer easy.
We love our contributors. That means you and New England College of Business and Finance. NECB offers special benefits for employees of its corporate partners. You can learn more about the benefits of the NECB Corporate Partnership Program at necb.edu. And Davis, Malm, and DeAugustine, PC, attorneys at law, knowing the lay of the land, not just the law. On the web at davismalm.com. DAVISMALM.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. And it's time for our Friday news quiz. It's a special edition. It's the Battle of the Bookers. And not only that, Marjorie, we have a live audience for the first time Woo! Ever. That was rather pathetic, actually. Now, in August, as I assume you guys know, it's notoriously hard to book guests, particularly in this town where all the doctors, the academics, and the luminaries take the month off. So since our bookers couldn't find anyone to book this week, they booked themselves. And that even proved to be a challenge since one of our bookers, Will Roselip, is off today. It's that bad. We had to tape this quiz yesterday. I know it's confusing. In order to have Will on the show. So here with us in Studio 3 is producer and booker Azita Garamani, battling producer and booker Will Roselip. Let's hear it for all of them.
Thank you, thank you.
Thanks.
Now, there was a little back and forth before this quiz in the newsroom.
A lot of hostility. Hostility. Oh, the back and forth went way back. It didn't even go just till before this quiz.
There's some hard feeling, obviously.
As soon as we heard, yeah, Will and I have a really nice relationship, or we used to have a really...
Past tense.
It's all over now. Really good relationship. As soon as we heard this was going to happen, you have no idea the amount of hostility I've been getting from Will.
Now, Azita, I know you don't want to disclose this, but it's too late now. What did you do last night in an attempt to throw Will off his game? Could you share that with us? Please.
Well, I was so nervous I couldn't sleep, and then all I could think, I was fixated on the idea that Will's getting a good night's rest, so I texted him every 30 seconds.
So every 15 or 20 minutes I hear this, Azita, come on, seriously?
And you were a little cocky in the pregame show. Edgar B. Herwick III interviewed both of you, and you were a little bold, I should say, Will.
I thought it's kind of a setup, because I thought it was going to be the thing where we go head-to-head, and there's like the final countdown playing in the background.
Yeah.
But no, Azita was like so nice, and like talked about all my good qualities, and meanwhile I'm like, oh, it's going to be a landslide.
She
so
did.
I don't look like a jerk.
You talked about Azita. A landslide, and Azita was feeling sick to her stomach with nerves. I think you just totally psyched her out. So I think
you
we should
did.
Give...
I feel so bad. I'm sorry for being so
frosty.
It's okay.
I'm just doing it. It's a manipulative motion on my part.
And by the way, we should say the reason that Will is off today, sort of today, or whatever it is because Friday night he is playing cello with his group, and he will play for us a little bit later during the quiz. Let's get it started, Marjorie. You can ask Azita a question.
Okay, Azita, you ready?
Ready.
Who is this man, and why is he in the news this week?
I was rushing so fast to get dressed to avoid more harassment by the press that apparently, from what they say, I didn't zip up my pants.
Okay.
Do you remember who that person was that forgot to zip up his pants?
Oh, my God. I have no idea. The only person I can think of is Anthony Weiner, but that didn't sound like him.
We should give her a half point for that. You know, a little bit of a hint here, since a little bit of a hint. The Boston Herald, when they had the photograph of this particular person coming up at his house with his pants down, did one of those white
unzipped
circles around his pants unzipped. Does that help you at all? It's about a year or two ago, no?
No, I don't.
Still
I can toss it to... Listen, I have to ask you guys before we go on.
Sure.
In the event that the Greater Boston staff hears this segment and I fail miserably...
Yeah.
Would you guys, if they want to let go of me, would you guys take me on?
Because
no,
I'm worried about my future now.
Not if you don't know any answers.
Absolutely.
No, obviously.
Yes,
so you
will.
Can steal the question, Will Roselip. Do you know the answer?
I just want to say before answering, I checked with Dennis up in HR, and he said we cannot be fired for not doing well in the quiz.
Thank you.
And I have no idea.
I spoke to Dennis after you did, by the way. Well, the answer is it's City Councilor Chuck Turner, right, Marjorie? Why is he
Absolutely.
In the news?
He is in the news because he was released from prison to a halfway house in Boston. He was serving a 3-year sentence, and he's gotten out a little bit early. And he's now in a halfway house. Don't you remember? He came out of his house and he was chased by, I believe it was a Fox News reporter and their cameraman that photographed Chuck with his fly down.
Ooh. By the way, you're both off to a really good start, I should say. Now, Will, here's your question. Okay. Who is this newsmaker in this clip and why did he make the news this particular week?
Why the f*** would I tell you about it? I've told you to f*** off twice and yet you're still here.
You should tell me about it because it's a scheduled media appearance by this department's Secretary of State, so therefore it falls well within my purview.
Within your purview?
Yes.
Where do you think you are? In some f***ing Regency costume drama? This is a government department, not a f***ing Jane f***ing novel.
Okay, so again, who is the newsmaker in the clip and why did he make the news this week? Please, Will Roselip.
Swing and a miss. I have no idea. Hugh Grant.
Hugh Grant. That's actually a very good guess. Do you want to guess Anthony Weiner again or not?
I was actually going to guess Anthony Weiner with a British accent.
Do you have any idea who it is?
I have no idea.
No, that's a tough one. That was actor Peter Capaldi, whoever he is.
Never heard of him.
In the film The Loop.
Who?
Exactly. On Sunday, the world learned he's been tapped to take over the titular protagonist of the cult series that's been on forever. Doctor Who hasn't been on for decades. Decades, yes.
1963.
Wait, you're asking us fictional news stories?
Yes, we are. No, actually, it's real. Now, judges, what is the score after one round, please? Oh, it is 0-0.
So you're tied. So it's great.
That is tied.
Don't worry.
Right. You're tied.
It's either, anything can happen. Okay. We have digitally changed this person's voice. I didn't even know we had that capacity here.
Yeah,
apparently,
we
have a voice changer. Who is this person talking, and what is he describing in his digitally changed voice?
It's amazing how life works. It is a whole bowl of awkward. I mean, there's no question about it.
That was Dan Shaughnessy talking about the purchase of the Boston Globe by John Henry.
On what show, please?
On none other than Boston Public Radio.
Thank you very much, Azita.
Okay,
Thank
the pressure's
goodness.
On now.
Look at her.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, since it was also
I can breathe, finally.
It was on your show as well, Greater Boston
yes,
as well. You
we
used that quote, so good thing you're watching your own
you know,
show.
Brian McGorry came on, the editor of the Globe right after that, and said the guy who has the single safest job in Boston is Dan Shaughnessy. That's obviously the case, is it not, Azita? I mean, there's no way Henry's going to mess with Shaughnessy, is he?
There's no way. There's no way. Just as there's no way either of you are going to mess with me or Will.
Exactly. Exactly. Jim Browdy, you then proceeded to harass Brian McGorry about his own job.
I didn't harass him. I asked him a couple of times yesterday. In any case, about whether his job was secure. And he said he expects to be there for a long time. Now, Will, this is your opportunity to... And by the way, if we didn't make clear, Azita is a producer and booker on Greater Boston.
Yes.
And Will is obviously one of our crack team.
That's right.
Here in Boston Public Radio. Here's your opportunity to tie this thing up, Will. Anthony Weiner had a senior moment yesterday. Please listen.
We honor the challenges that seniors have.
If Anthony Weiner is trying to win over senior citizens, insulting Republican rival George McDonald over his age may not be the best way to do it. Weiner accused his 69-year-old opponent of having anger issues and called him...
Here's the question, Will. What did Weiner call his Republican rival for mayor? Do you know?
Anthony Weiner called him grandpa.
That is exactly correct.
Woo!
Give him the points.
That's
no applause
great.
For
Woo!
Will. Let's hear it.
Oh.
Thank you. Azita even applauded for him. Now, here's a follow-up question for which I don't think you get any points, but just for fun. Who sponsored this forum where this this big mistake happened? And it's relevant who sponsored it if you think about the answer.
AARP?
That is exactly right, Will.
Okay.
So you're tied.
You're tied.
The pressure's off. You both got one right. You can
That's
go
right.
home now.
That's
okay.
the thing. As long as you can do
oh, yes.
one of these questions right. I mean, it's terrible if you get none of them right. But as long as you get one, you're kind of off the hook.
I don't think so.
That's
now,
right.
in any
is
case,
over now?
Will, no, it is not.
No,
Will,
it's not.
You are playing Friday night. Where are you playing?
We're playing at the Lily Pad in Inman Square in Cambridge.
Love Inman Square.
We're going to be doing Transfigure Night by Schoenberg. We're going to be doing some songs by the artist Beck. He's the guy who did Two Turntables and a Microphone, New Pollution, all that kind of stuff. So it's at 8 o'clock Friday, and come there, drink some beer and wine with us.
Now, what do you play in this group of yours?
I played cello. I played cello 2. I'm not quite good enough to play cello 1 yet.
But... So you're going
to
play a little for us right now?
Yeah, I think I might.
Oh, my goodness. Will Roseless.
This is a piece that Azita
cello.
Suggested I play, and I thought it was a good idea. So this is the first Bach Suite Prelude.
Very collegial of you. Why did you propose this particular piece, Azita? Can you
because
tell us?
Because it's extremely difficult.
Well, Will Roseless is now sitting in a chair in the corner. The microphone has been moved. This is our producer, booker, and Azita's former friend and opponent, Will Roseless, playing whatever he said a couple of minutes ago. Here he is, Will. Now, Azita, what do you have, a kazoo or something? What are you doing?
I have no talents whatsoever to bring to this show.
That was beautiful.
That was really fantastic. That is really hard.
That was beautiful.
I mean, that is gorgeous.
I'd like to hear cello 1, to tell you the truth, after that. Okay, at the end of one round.
It's like our own Yo-Yo Ma.
At the end of one round, it is 1-1. And the next question, I believe, is from Marjorie Egan. Azita. Now, we should say, for those who just tuned in, the premise for this week's quiz is ordinarily the bookers book guests for the quiz. But it's August, and it's very hard to book guests, so we decided to book the bookers. And Azita from Greater Boston is in a contest with Will from Boston Public Radio.
Okay.
Take it away, Marjorie.
So you know the race is fixed.
It's 1-1.
Okay, Azita from Greater Boston, who's Conan O'Brien referring to in this clip?
President Obama, this is the big story, has called off a summit with because of diplomatic differences. Also, Obama didn't like man that the summit be held shirtless and on horseback.
Well, that's none other than the shirtless Putin.
Vladimir Putin.
That is correct. Here's a bonus question, Azita. Why is their relationship extra frosty right now?
Because of the friendly relationships between Putin and Edward Snowden.
Oh, yes.
Woo!
Give her something for that.
Excellent.
By the way, what do you think of Putin shirtless? Have you seen the photographs? What do you think of those, Azita, to be honest?
I have seen them, and I don't know. I've seen pictures of
HGH.
I've seen pictures of other presidents shirtless, and I think that it's kind of a standoff between the U.S. and it's the Cold War all over
That's
again.
Right.
But he's got no hair on his chest, which I find is a relatively.
Does Obama, you studied the picture of Obama coming out of the water in Hawaii.
I have.
He hairless or hairy?
He's hairless, but he's got a certain je ne sais quoi, don't you think, Will?
Absolutely. But I think it's weirder with Putin because it's so cold there. You'd think he'd have a little bear skin on the front of him to stay warm. Natural bear skin.
What is cold? I mean, I hesitate to say this, but in the photograph, his nipples were hard. If you look at that, I mean, they were. I'm sorry. He brought it up. I didn't
say
anything.
That's a pretty crucial detail.
Okay, now fine. Will, the next question is for you. You ready?
Okay. Yep.
Here is a news clip from earlier this week, please.
Jeopardy's Facebook page is now being flooded with comments that say things like, shame on you, Alex, and Jeopardy. And the show responded to the following statement that said, if Jeopardy were to give credit for an incorrect response, however minor, the show would effectively penalize the other players.
This is a great story. What did Alex Trebek and the Jeopardy judges do that inflamed and outraged legions of viewers, Will Roseless?
They basically told a guy his answer was wrong for writing... It was something like the Emancipation Proclamation instead of the real one.
That's exactly right.
They didn't give him half credit or anything.
That's correct. Thomas Hurley III, thank you for the little half bell there, was in the last round of Kids Jeopardy when he correctly answered a question about the Emancipation Proclamation, but he misspelled the word emancipation, putting the T in front of the A. He was disqualified for misspelling his
You guys are more lenient than that.
Yeah, how nasty. That was really wrong.
It was wrong.
It's like child abuse. Trebek to you.
Trebek, whatever his name is.
What's the score, judges? What is it? 3-1. No, but
We don't know.
I think we're
3-2. They try.
The fix is in.
Chelsea just said usually Will keeps score. That's why they made the mistake. So it's 3-2 with Zita. You can lengthen your lead right here.
Okay, ready, Zita? Here's President Barack Obama on Jay Leno earlier this week. What event is he describing?
We played a little golf, and then we tried to play a little basketball, and it was a sad state of affairs.
Really?
Yeah. A bunch of old guys. And afterwards, where's the ibuprofen and all that stuff?
Okay. Do you know what event he was describing, Isidro?
I'm having a complete brain. What's it called?
Don't say it. Yes.
I can't remember. Only
Freeze.
Thing I can think is it wasn't, clearly it wasn't lunch with Hillary Clinton.
It wasn't.
No.
Now, Will, get this right, Will, do you know that you tie up the whole game after three rounds? What event?
Oh, my God. I'm going to say vacationing on Martha's Vineyard.
Is that right,
good
Marjorie?
Guess. That is not correct. It's what he did on his birthday. He turned 52 on Sunday.
Oh.
Birthday. Oh. I don't think he's old yet.
Birthday. No, he's not. Now, here's an
opportunity.
Was he shirtless?
Hairless.
He was not. Sure,
did you comment on his nipples, Jim? Would you care to make a comment?
I said it once, and we should move on from that. Now, Will, here's yet another opportunity.
Really study that picture.
For you to tie it up. It's because I read that in one of your columns, Marjorie. It's the only reason I knew it,
another
actually.
Another bromance, too.
Now, here it is. Will, you ready for this?
Yes.
What are these super tasters describing? What is it?
It's not that juicy. The absence is, I feel like, the fat. You know, like, it's a leanness to it. But the bite, you know, feels, this is kind of an unnatural experience.
Will has the biggest smile I've ever seen on. Will, you happen to know
only
what that
because,
is?
Only because we covered this earlier this week, yes.
Is that fair, Azita? We covered it earlier this week? Okay, what's the answer?
Okay, they're talking about the test tube hamburger.
Exactly, that
test
is exactly
hamburger.
Right.
Yeah, it sounded really disgusting to me.
300 grand. Do you think it's fair that he got a question about something we did earlier this week on the
show?
Not at all.
Not at all. I hope you guys pulled some sound from Greater Boston.
Yeah, I think you should lodge a complaint about that. That was absolutely outrageous. Did you slip that in, Will?
I may have.
What's that?
Okay.
Okay, exactly.
Is this the bonus round?
This is the bonus round. Now, what is the score? I'm sorry to keep asking you. 3-3, which means the results of the bonus round will decide who this week's champion
is. Now I'm getting very
nervous. Oh, this is so clever. Listen to this.
Yeah.
Since both of you are bookers, we're going to ask you questions about the Booker Prize, the literary prize awarded each year for the best original full-length
Look
novel.
Look at Zita. Zita is excited.
Yeah, I have never read a book in my life, just for the record.
It's okay.
Go ahead. What is it?
It's the best original full-length novel written in the English language by a citizen of the Commonwealth of Nations, Ireland, or Zimbabwe.
Of course it is.
Okay. Here we go. Question number one. How do they answer? They just tap their hands, or what do they do here, Jim?
No, it's an A, B, or C.
Oh, A, B, or C. Yeah. Okay, so question one is to Azita. 89 winner went to the novel Remains of the Day. The book is about Stevens, a British butler who recalls his life in the form of a diary. The bulk of the book revolves around the butler's professional and personal relationship with a former colleague, housekeeper Miss Kenton. Which among these three is the first line of the book? A. The house guests who come and go know me as Stevens, the loyal butler to Lord Darlington. B. It seems increasingly likely that I will undertake the expedition that has been preoccupying my imagination now for some days. Or C. I always thought Miss Kenton beautiful, impeccably wise, and unwittingly oblivious to my feelings for her.
And D. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
I go with D.
Sorry.
I would say A, and that's a complete guess. I actually have read that book, but it was so many years ago, I can't remember. It's a really great book.
We don't have the answer,
judges. We don't have the answer, but I bet you're right.
Okay, it's
not
A.
Can I get it? If we don't have the answer, then I should get it.
No, we know it is not A. We were just told by the judges. Now, Will, do you know which it is?
I'm feeling unwittingly oblivious, but I'll guess either – or no, I won't guess both of them. I'll guess B.
Is that correct, judges? That is correct. Aww. What do you mean, aw? That's really not very good sportsmanship, Zeta.
What a terrible first line. Who would even begin a novel like
what
that?
Was the, what seriously. It seems increasingly likely that I really will undertake the expedition. Has been preoccupying my imagination now for some days.
That's
actually
horrible.
I have to confess, I saw the movie, and the first line of the movie was the one about being the butler.
Yes, you're right. And the guy, Hannibal Lecter played the butler, right?
That's right. That's right.
And beautiful, who was the woman that played the beautiful Miss Kenton that he was in love with?
Chelsea should be doing the quiz, not us. Okay, now, Will, you could lengthen your lead here and make it nearly impossible for Zeta to ever catch up. You ready?
I'm ready.
Which of these is a Booker Prize first? A, shortlisting a graphic novel by Neil Gaiman. B, shortlisting a collection of short stories by Alice Munro. C, shortlisting a young adult book by Siobhan Parker. What's the correct answer? Which is it?
Correct answer is B.
That is exactly right, Alice Munro.
Wow, that was very impressive, Will.
Now, I know, Azita, you're suffering from mild depression, but here's the good news. While you are 2 points behind, Marjorie and I have just conferred, and we decided the final question is worth 2 points. So if you were to get this correct, you could tie this and go home with some dignity.
If I miss it, though, I miss all the points, right? I get deducted 2 points.
Well, you lose. If you get it wrong, you are in second place out of two.
Okay,
so go ahead.
Azita, you ready?
Wait. Can you go to the easy question at the end?
This is a very easy
This is the only question that's left.
It's about the Booker Prize.
It's about the Booker Prize. Which of these Booker Prize controversies is true? A, in 1992, the Booker Prize went to Canadian writer Michael, I can never pronounce his last name, he wrote The English Patient.
Ondaatje.
Thank you.
Thank you. Give her a point for that.
A British critic wrote, quote, "The end is no nigh. It is decidedly here. A heap of sentimental rubbish has claimed one of literature's highest honors," unquote. To protest this diss, Canadians formed a human chain around the British embassy. That is A. B, in 1972, the Booker Prize went to socialist writer John Berger. At his acceptance speech, he maligned England's history of colonialism. He also donated half his prize money to the Black Panthers. Or C, in 1997, there was a draw between Arundhati Roy's book, The God of Small Things, I probably mispronounced that, and the novel Grace Notes. According to The Guardian, the publisher of Grace Notes tried to bribe one of the judges to throw his vote. The judge was so upset by this that he gave the vote to the other book.
Wait, so this is supposed to be the easy question?
It is
a hard question.
Everybody knows this, Azita.
Can I use a lifeline?
So what's the question anyway? Which of those is true? Is that the question?
Yes, which of those is true? Canadians formed a human chain around the embassy. John Berger donated half his prize money in 1972 to the Black Panthers. Or there was a big bribe by one of the judges to throw his vote. And the judge was so upset he gave a vote to another vote. I mean, he gave his vote to another book.
I'm just going to guess B.
You are correct.
She is right.
We end up
in a tie. Listen to the audience going wild over this thing. Now, do you, Azita, since it did end in a tie, do you think this was a fair fight in light of the fact that, as we said, Will is part of this particular program, obviously. He did not have the questions in advance, but he does have the loyalty of people like me and Marjorie.
Wait, is the fight over?
So that is done, yeah.
Oh, okay, so we both come away with the Booker Prize.
That's
right.
You do, exactly.
That's great. Yeah.
That was very generous of you. Do you have anything to say, Will?
Azita was a very fair competitor, and she's a much better person than I am. And I'm so glad to not have a cold war up at our cubicle again after this is all over.
And we would only ask, I should say, on behalf of me and Marjorie, next week, try to book real people for this quiz. Now, Will is kind enough, because you can't play anything, Azita. Will is going to play
you
us
have to remind me.
Out of this segment and into the weekend. What are you playing this time, please, Will?
I'm going to play another cut from the Bach Suites. This one's in C major for everybody there with perfect pitch.
And tell everybody about Will's event.
Yes, Will is playing at the Lily Pad, 1353 Cambridge Street, tonight at 8 p.m. Again, that's Friday, August 9th at 8 p.m. It's only $10. You get to hear Will and his colleagues. For tickets and more info, you go to Cambridge Phil, P-H-I-L, as in philharmonic.org. Can we have one round of applause for the two contestants, please, while waiting for Will? Azita Garamani, it was a pleasure from Greater Boston.
Thank you.
And Will Roselip, we love you. And here he is playing the cello. As we say, have a wonderful weekend. Now, if you just tuned in, and you wondered, wasn't Marjorie off for the first half of the show, but on for the second? Well, you missed the introduction of the quiz, where we mentioned that since Will is playing tonight at the Lily Pad, 6 hours from now, actually, in Cambridge, that we taped the quiz yesterday, thanks to all of them. I want a couple of house cleaning things. I want to alert you to a great event tomorrow for you and your family. It's in Quincy from 11 to 4 to support our troops and their families. You can go to gingerbetties.com for information. Number two, we never thank enough the people that make this show possible. Tori Bedford, Amanda McGowan, John Parker, Will Roselip, and our leader on all this, Chelsea Mers. And finally, to tell you a little bit about Monday's show when Marjorie will be back, we'll talk politics with Globe columnist Scott Lehi and political strategist Kelly Bates, who is now leading a new exciting initiative at Emerson College. She'll tell us about that as well. Have a wonderful weekend, and go into that weekend listening to the great Will Roselip. Here he is.